windows. The walls were so warped, thin drifts of snow had silted in through the chinks. From the lingering aroma of aluminum and that small mountain of crushed empties in one corner, she suspected the original owner was some guy who came out to get away from it all. A little shooting, a lot of boozing, what's not to like? Judging from the rose light spraying an intact west window, it was late afternoon. Out of habit, Alex's eyes automatically fell to Ellie's Mickey Mouse watch, still on her wrist. 7:13. Of course, that wasn't the correct time. For Mickey, it was always 7:13, the moment when the watch finally threw in the towel after all that water. Another minute or so under the snow, and she figured she would have too. Anyway, call it 5 o'clock. Wolf and the others should be back soon. Oh, goody. God, I hope he's got something. An awful thought, but it wasn't as if getting all broody about it would help whoever Wolf hunted down. Carefully easing Leopard's knife into a dented camp pot seated over coals in the cabin's fireplace, she gave her blood-red pine-bark stew a stir. She couldn't live on this stuff. It was famine food, like acorns. Of course, since she was starving, it was better than nothing. Hadn't she read somewhere that you could fry the bark with olive oil, add a dash of salt? Yeah, the backwoods equivalent of potato chips. At the thought, a ghostly aroma of crunchy fried potatoes, of grease and salt, made her mouth water. Come on, cut it out. This was the problem with hunger. All you thought about was food. She had to get a grip. Having been here before, she knew she was heading into dangerous territory as her body crept ever closer day by day to a very desperate place. Every time she pushed to stand now, she got dizzy. The pit of her stomach was a continual, sharp, beaky gnaw. Sometimes she thought her monster had migrated down and was trying to eat its way out of her guts.
"We're all starving."
She poked at the pine, moving very slowly, all too aware of Acne's glittery stare and the urgent raw fog of his hunger, and just how closely his Mossberg tracked her. The last thing she needed was for Acne to mistake a sudden move and splatter her brains over a lousy piece of boiled bark. Given how famished he was, he might do it anyway, then beg Wolf's forgiveness later. "Yeah, boss, I know. Bad call." Acne's hunger had a real reek, too, the gassy aroma of fermenting fruit. Wonder if I smell the same way. She'd never stopped to think much about that. Probably, to Acne and the others, she smelled like raw steak. Nice southwest rub, juicy and done rare, so the fat melts when you take a bite. "Oh, God, what I wouldn't give for a steak," she said. To her left, Acne's response was a fresh fume of rot and starvation. No surprise. If only Acne hadn't been in such a rush to get back indoors. Outside, she'd spotted all that chicken wire and thought, "Garden?" Somehow, those crushed cans argued against it, but it was worth checking out. Man, she would kill for a wrinkly old potato or wizened carrot. Also near the garden, against a shed, was a weird mound that smelled like a bakery. A compost pile? Could be. Stuff that hadn't rotted yet, especially with the cold. Gnawed melon rinds, leathery apple cores, half-eaten cobs. Banana peels had potassium. She would take anything she could get, boil the hell out of it, swallow it back, and not think too hard about it. And what about that rickety shed? People left all kinds of things in drawers, or tucked in knapsacks, or hanging from hooks and joists, jammed in glove compartments, petrified granola bars, candy, power bars, those little boxes of raisins and bags of nuts. Just thinking about what she might find made the saliva pool under her tongue. And there could be other things I might use. Sheds were excellent places to forage for weapons. Anything would do. She wasn't persnickety. Nails, an old hammer, rope, electrical cords, saw blades. A gun would be best, but shotgun shells would be almost as good. Crack 'em for the powder, make bang sticks, something. Yet she had to be cautious. She had more freedom this time around. Wolf let her forage and keep Leopard's knife. No way in hell she'd risk losing that. The knife and a flint striker were her only survival tools. Without them, she was as good as dead when and if she managed to make a run for it.
When and if? Oh, dream on, honey.
Honestly, some days even she got exasperated with herself. This was like sitting through Titanic. Just sink already. She was always under guard. And exactly where would she hide all these marvelous weapons? Get herself caught, and she could kiss her little foraging forays goodbye. Then she'd completely starve. While Wolf might protect her, she didn't think he'd take kindly to her whacking him with a crowbar, if she even could, because she already had a knife. That Wolf let her keep it after that first day was nothing short of miraculous. Yet had she gotten all Princess Bride and slunk around at night to slit a couple throats? To reach over as Wolf lay dreaming his happy, lusty little wolf dreams and cut out his heart?
No. Get real.
That stuff only happened in the same books where the heroine scarfed down raw white pine. This was real life. And yet she had motive. She had opportunity. She knew exactly where the carotids were and how deeply to hack. Do it fast, and she actually might pull it off. After all, it was only 5 against 1, so what was she waiting for?
Well, hell, I don't know.
Focus on what you can do, all right. Like that garden. You ought to check it out. Sighing, she sheathed her knife.
If I get a chance.
Acne exploded. No warning, no red alerts from the monster, no change in Acne's scent at all. Really, how much hungrier could the kid get? And he did it fast, in absolute silence, launching himself like a missile she only half-registered from the corner of her eye. Gasping, she jerked her arm partway up as his fist rocketed for her face. The hit was blinding, a stunning white detonation in her left cheek just below her eye. A cry tried jumping off her tongue, but then his hand muscled around her throat, clutching at her jaw. Yanking her upright, Acne began drunk walking her across the cabin. Ah! Ben! She wheezed as she stumbled off balance, her hands hooked onto his. Ben, don't! Stop! Stop! But Acne, the boy who'd called himself Ben Steimke, was an insatiable storm in the mood for meat. Driving her the length of the room, Acne slammed her against the wall. Her head thunked hard enough for her vision to drop out like a jump cut in time. Her jaw snapped. Pain erupted in a red dazzle as her teeth tore her tongue. Blood flooded into her throat. Gagging, she felt Acne's hand shift and knew instantly what he was going to do. Panic sheeted her brain. Try to kill her by strangulation, and she still had a chance. A knee to his groin, a punch, maybe take out his eyes with her fingers, but pinch off her carotids in a blood choke, and she'd gray out in seconds, be dead in minutes with a lot less fuss. Then she thought, the Tanto. She'd sheathed the knife. Dropping her right shoulder, she twisted, fingers straining. It was a desperate move, hopeless from the start, because even in a killing frenzy, Acne read the set of her body. Viper fast, he snatched the tanto from its sheath and turned the blade until that razor tip was poised over her left eye. Her blood slushed. She stopped fighting. She could see how this would go. A quick flash of cold steel, and then she'd be screeching, eye gone, the screaming socket dripping eye jelly and blood. They hung there, unmoving, a shuddering instant out of time. Then Acne dragged in a harsh preparatory breath, and she had time to think. No! Lips peeled in a snarl, Acne drove forward. Whirring, the knife flickered past her face to bury itself in the wall. From the green, liverish stink boiling from his skin, she knew then that however much Acne wanted to rip out her throat and gorge himself on her meat, feel its warmth and her blood in his mouth, first he wanted her to suffer. He had her, and he was going to enjoy this. He would enjoy her. She began to thrash. Bracing her back against the wood, she kicked, aiming for Acne's groin. But this wasn't as it had been days ago in the snow. His reach was so much longer, it wasn't really a contest, and he arched out of the way. Yet it did her some good, bought her just a few more seconds, because he had to shift his grip to hang on. As soon as he let up, she managed a single sip, a terrible sensation of dragging air through a rapidly collapsing straw, and then that was it, and not nearly enough. She had nothing with which to fight, and she was starting to lose it, her vision going first blurry, then moth-eaten. Deep in the dark, the monster came alive, a spider skittering in the cave of her skull, and then she was tumbling into that black whirlpool behind Acne's eyes, watching her face growing the color of an eggplant, the whites showing in half-moons as her eyes rolled, the end of her life unspooled in a jumble of images, Acne choking her, but only to the point where she passed out, then allowing her to wake, driving her to the floor, letting her wake just enough to do it all over again, 3 times, maybe 4, with the peculiar sadism of a kid pulling wings off flies before crushing them underfoot. He would wait for her to surface, regain consciousness, all the better to feel the instant his teeth clamped onto her throat and tore, and her blood fountained to bathe his cheeks a bright, stinging red. From somewhere, there came a hard bang that might have been sharper and louder, but for the cotton stuffing her ears. An instant later, Acne let out a sudden, sickening, "Ugh!" and the pressure around her neck was gone. Why, she didn't know. Something scraped her back. Wood, the wall, I'm falling. Hacking, she landed in a heap, limp as wet laundry. For a few seconds, all she concentrated on was dragging air through a throat that felt as stable as the crushed stem of a tulip. Through the blur that passed for her vision, she saw them, Wolf and Acne, across the room, facing off. The air in the cabin had quickened, popping and crackling with heat, the acrid sting of murder, the cold steel of Wolf's rage. Blood trickled from Acne's nose, and he was shaking his head like a bull. Crouching, eyes narrowed, Wolf began to circle. Acne tried to follow, but he was either still stunned from Wolf's first punch or simply weakened by lack of food, because he stumbled. Seizing his chance, Wolf ducked and charged. Dazed, Acne actually backed up and tried to sidestep, but not fast enough. Plowing into Acne, Wolf wrapped his arms around the other boy's waist and gave a mighty heave. Acne's legs flew out from under as Wolf upended and then smashed him to the floor. Acne's head rebounded against wood with a sharp crack. His limbs went limp, the connections between brain and body winking out as Wolf dropped like a boulder on top of him. He brought his fist down like a hammer, once, twice. A huge roar shook the cabin. From her place on the floor, Alex saw Marley, long dread, still frosty from cold, swinging the Mossberg's muzzle from the ceiling and bringing it to bear on the two boys. Wolf and Acne froze in an almost comical tableau, Wolf astride Acne's chest, his bloody fist cocked for another blow. Acne's eyes were swelling and purpling in a mask of blood. Combined with all those acne scars, the boy looked as if his skin were being chewed from the inside out. His chest was a broad bib of red. With every breath, blood bubbled through his shattered nose. To Marley's left were the brothers, Bert and Ernie. From the smell drifting out of that green duffel slung over Bert's shoulder, she knew that the woman was frail and birdie, wreathed in a fruity bouquet of starvation with very little meat. Look at it a certain way, maybe Wolf and his crew had only done the birdie woman a favor, in the same way that sheriffs shot deer too weak to even realize they'd wandered into the middle of the road during a hard winter. If, that is, you really could see things from the changed point of view. It scared her a little that she could. Wolf didn't kill Acne, and neither did any in his crew. What they did was send Acne packing. Curled in a corner, throat aching, cheek throbbing, Alex kept still as Acne, moving very slowly and stiffly, rolled up his sleeping bag under Wolf's watchful eye and Marley's Mossberg.
"Don't notice me."
She hugged her knees a little closer.
"Don't see me. I'm not here."
Fat chance of that. Through it all, she thought about the monster, that jump behind Acne's eyes, Wolf's sudden appearance. It was possible that Wolf was close by anyway and banged through the door just in time.
But just as likely that the monster had something to do with this, same as when I was under the snow.
Now, as then, she'd been teetering on the edge of consciousness, and the monster panicked. Wouldn't be the first time. And what the hell was she going to do about that? What could she do?
Got to think of something. Got to keep the monster under control.
Her face throbbed. She thought about her med pack. Might be something for pain.
No, stay sharp. It's when you start to lose it that the monster gets out.
She sucked blood from a tear on her lower lip.
I can take this. Besides, I really ought to save that stuff for when we need it.
Only after another second did she truly hear what she just thought.
We? Stop it, Alex. You're going to drive yourself crazy.
For want of anything better to do, she watched as Bert grabbed that green duffel, pulled it up, gave the nylon bag a shake. The birdie woman's body slithered out in a loose-limbed splay like a limp, white, plucked chicken. After Bert smoothed the duffel on the floor, Ernie rolled the body onto the sack, then pulled a well-used knife with a fine and silvery edge from a leg sheath and went to work.
Don't look, Alex.
Fighting the sting of tears, she dropped her head on her knees. The air bloomed with wet iron, raw meat, fresh bone.
Hell with the monster. You're Alex. You'll always be Alex, no matter what.
She felt the suck of cold air as the door closed behind Acne. A moment later, she heard hesitant footsteps coming toward her. Even before he knelt, before she felt his tentative hand in her hair, she knew who it was. For a moment, she didn't move, but not because she was afraid. She didn't move because, God help her, she wasn't scared of him at all. Wolf's rage, that steel bite, was gone. What remained was rot and mist, gassy flesh and crisp apples, and for a second she surrendered to a very simple, basic need. For her, at that moment, even the touch of a monster would do.
I am so scared.
All at once she was crying, silently, shoulders shuddering, angry at herself, too.
Stop this! Stop this! No one will rescue you but you! No one else can!
Yet here was Wolf, and she wasn't fighting this or him. Maybe she should, but she was so worn out. She felt his hand move through her hair, very gently, quite carefully, as if he were trying not to hurt her more than she was already.
Don't touch me! Don't touch me!
But she wanted this, craved it, a touch that was not a blow, and she thought that meant she was pretty far gone. She let his fingers travel over her uninjured cheek, felt his thumbs skim away her tears, trace her jaw. When he lifted her chin, she didn't fight that either. Wolf's face, Chris's face, was very still, watchful, trying to understand, she thought. His dark eyes were riveted to hers, as if trying to see behind these windows to her mind. His scent was hard to read, but it was light and floral, the smell of safe and family. There might even be a smidgen of pity there, or sympathy.
Please let me go, Wolf.
She winced against the stinging swallow of salt.
Don't you see? I don't belong with you. I'm not one of you.
Nothing changed in his scent. Maybe nothing could, because he couldn't understand, or didn't want to. But his thumb kept stroking her cheek the way you might comfort a small child or lost kitten. Right around then, she realized she wasn't crying anymore, either.
What type of monster are you, Wolf?
It was a question she could have asked herself. What was she now? What lived in her head that could do these things? Jump behind Acne's eyes, slide into spider, slither into leopard, reach for Wolf?
The monster wants him.
Because she did?
No, not like that. Never.
Whatever the monster was doing, its needs were its own. She had to believe that, or she might as well use the tanto on herself.
But what if I can use the monster somehow?
Her mind brushed that idea, lightly, not lingering, a touch that was as gentle as Wolf's on her cheek.
What if I can control when and how the monster jumps? Or maybe let the monster try to reach Wolf, talk to him?
just let go and get into Wolf and see myself the way he really sees me?
What? Abruptly she sat up. What the hell are you thinking, Alex? Her voice came out angry, and that was something Wolf understood, because she saw him flinch, felt his hand fall away from her face. I'm going outside. She wasn't going to run, she wasn't stupid, but she had to get out of this miserable little room with its smells of death and changed. Walking the wall with her hands, she made her feet. For a moment, she thought Wolf would try to help. Don't, she said, flattening herself against cold wood. Leave me alone. I don't want... She stopped talking then, the words turning to dust in her mouth as she saw Bert just beyond coming toward her with dinner. The arm was spindly. It was the right, not tons of meat. Tattered remnants of skin and ropey veins dragged over the pinkish knob of the birdie woman's funny bone and, oh God, the slim steel band of a watch was still tight around that twig of a wrist. Something seemed to snap in her head. She stared at the arm, horrified, and yet she was so hungry that this thought actually bubbled to the surface. If there's no other choice, if it's life or death... No! Grabbing back a scream, she bullied her way past Wolf and Bert. Clawing open the cabin door, she stumbled into the bronze dazzle of sunset. The cold was stunning, like blundering through glass, but she couldn't stay in that cabin another second. Of course, the changed would feed. They had to eat. But I do have a choice. After a half-dozen yards, her knees unlimbered, just plain gave out, and she toppled to the snow. She dug in until her face and neck and bare hands flinched with the cold. Eventually, she would feel the burn, which was fine. Burn my eyes out, take a blowtorch to my brain, anything. She dragged her head from side to side like a dog trying to get a bad smell out of its snout. I can't go down that road. I do that, then I might as well have eaten Jack and snacked on those kids, or let the monster out all the way. No matter what Wolf was thinking, what he wanted, she had to fight. Can't give in. Can't go there. Behind, she heard the cabin's door open, felt his eyes, knew his scent. He only watched, though, and didn't follow. I'm me. Ahead, by the shed, she saw that strange mound. I'm me. I'm Alex. She battled her way there, slithering through snow until the mound loomed. She knelt before it, sweeping her eyes over patchy snow, and spied a dark pinprick scurry over a patch of ice, and another pinprick, and another, and another. Fight! She thrust both fists into the mound, right up to her wrists. Almost at once, and despite the cold, a black tide boiled to the surface and over her forearms. Withdrawing a hand, she inspected her fingers, smeary with dirt and so many ants. Her skin was a black, writhing mat. Many carried eggs and tiny, milky larvae clamped in their mandibles. Do it, Alex, just do it. Hang on to who you are. Don't let them break you. Before her brain could really kick in and stop her, she stuck two fingers in her mouth and sucked. Ants foamed over her tongue. She tasted dirt, the coarse pop of grit and the yeasty tang of fermenting earth, felt the spidery scampering of many legs, the minute pricking of mandibles nipping at her flesh. But she bit down and killed them all and swallowed them back and went back for seconds and thirds, because yes... things were that bad. Chapter 40
Sarah, I know things are bad. That weird earthquake spooked everyone.
Greg broke off as Tori, with Ghost in tow, bustled into the church's main office.
Everything okay?
Yeah, what took you so long?
Prue had parked his butt on a desk still heaped with stacks of Xeroxed announcements for October 2. Given that they were at the end of the first week of March of the following year, an Amish friendship bread and whoopie pie church bake sale scheduled for October 8 last year was probably moot.
Cutter and Benton will be back in less than 20 minutes, and Greg and me have to be gone. A couple cans of refried beans only buy you so much time.
I know. I'm sorry. Caleb's pretty sick.
Tori backhanded honey blonde frizz from her forehead as Alex's gangly Weimaraner made a beeline for a muscular black German shepherd curled at Sarah's feet.
"Honestly," Tori said, "if one more kid decides to chow down on Play-Doh, I'm going to throw it all out."
Greg made a face. "Play-Doh? That stuff stinks."
"Not the homemade stuff. The little kids made it back when we actually had flour. Looks and smells like bread dough. Really salty, though."
Propping her shotgun, a Remington 870 with a carved floral design on the walnut stock in a corner, Tori said,
"Then I had to shake Becky. She wanted to know if I was going to see you."
"What? How'd she find out?" Greg blurted. At the dart of dismay in Tori's eyes, he wanted to kick himself. When the girls lived with Jess, he'd drunk so much tea just to be near Tori, he could have floated his own battleship. After Alex's escape and the ambush, the council moved Tori and Sarah into the church's rectory. That should have made things a little easier, especially since the girl's house mother, a lumbering hag named Hammerbach, keeled over from a stroke. But he always seemed to say the wrong thing.
"Becky saw me unlock the door while I was sweeping the basement. She was under the altar, playing hide-and-seek," she said. "But I think she was scoping out the pantry. A couple kids tried to break in yesterday." "Because they're starving."
A tiny girl to begin with, Sarah had shriveled. At her right hip, a holstered SIG P-225 jutted like a black knuckle bone. Greg wondered if she even knew how to fire the thing. She turned Greg a hollow stare.
"You can only live on watered-down oatmeal, corn syrup, peanut butter, and the occasional acorn for so long. We've already lost 7 kids. Another few weeks, they're going to start really dropping like the old people."
"Without their pills, those old guys were going to kick anyway," Prue said. "Nothing Kincaid can do about that either. Get pneumonia, kiss it goodbye. Going to be big trouble."
"We're already in deep trouble."
Sarah spooled a listless curl around a finger.
"Why do you think they moved all of us spared to the center of town? We get a little more to eat than everyone else, but they might as well paint a bullseye on our backs."
"Sarah's right," Tori said. "Wasn't it just yesterday that old man took a shot?"
"A 30-06, Prue said. "I thought Greg was going to shit his pants. That guy was just scared."
Greg still thought they could have talked the old man down, but Prue's Ruger Mini 14 put the period to that conversation. In a bedroom, they found what the old guy was protecting, a cage of 3 scrawny parakeets. The sight made Greg want to cry.
"But people are shooting back, and it's worse since the rationing. They're killing horses, they're shooting dogs."
Sarah ruffled the shepherd's ears.
"Jet and Ghost are still alive because they guard the kids, and Daisy's yours, Greg, but they'll come for them too eventually."
"Then people, I bet."
Prue's expression darkened. "Start off with the real old guys who won't last much longer anyway." "Eating people? Come on, get real," Greg said. "This isn't Lord of the Flies. The council would never allow it."
"Oh, like they're so relevant."
Prue gave an exaggerated eye roll. "The only reason they've held on this long is because everyone was fed and the village was real tight before everything went to hell. They had Peter, their miracle boy, too old to change, not old enough to survive, but spared anyway, and his grandpa's on the council. Then here comes Chris, another spared, and oh, he just happens to be Jaeger's grandson. A total god thing, and everyone calmed down. Peter cleared out the changed, killed them all. People were fed, they felt safer. Remember their ceremonies on Sundays? How Jaeger would bless us and spout all that crap about holy missions? Now with Peter and Chris gone and nothing coming in, it's all falling apart.
Then we have to get out before we all starve or get traded for food or something," Sarah said. "Or maybe they'll only pass us girls around as a reward, the way some stare, like Cutter."
"Cutter?"
Something flitted through Tori's eyes, but when she said nothing, Greg looked back at Sarah. "He's one of your guards."
"Yeah, and I sleep so much better knowing he's got keys. He hasn't done anything, but you can hear the wheels turning. If he could figure a way..."
"I'll get him moved somewhere else."
"It'll end up being the same no matter who gets posted."
Tori's voice was strangely toneless.
I never used to worry. When Peter and Chris were in charge, they were like this indestructible team. But now... She turned him a shimmery look.
Greg, we can't count on the adults anymore. We need to take care of ourselves. So either we take over or we leave.
Greg threw up his hands. And go where? East is out. Lot of cities, lot of people, a ton have changed. That's why Peter and Chris didn't want us patrolling out that way. South is no good either. Once beyond the mine and closer to Iron Mountain, it starts getting real crowded.
If there's anyone left...
Tori wrinkled her nose.
I don't like South anyway.
That earthquake 2 weeks ago, from the cave-in, that was pretty weird.
If a cave-in's all it was.
A finger of unease dragged over Greg's neck. Subsurface vibrations was what one of the old-timers had said.
You can get spontaneous combustion in a coal mine, but the rule mine was iron first, gold second, and the rocks inert. For that mine to cave bad enough to set off an earthquake, you need high explosives, and a lot of them.
Which begged the questions, who had access to high explosives, and why do it at all? Aloud, he said,
So that leaves West, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Wyoming.
Prue said,
Betcha it's pretty empty.
Or we go north, maybe even into Canada.
Orin is north, Sarah said. Chris and Lena went north.
There was a silence.
They went east, Greg said.
Greg, Chris knew east was dangerous, and he's been to Orin. So if he's alive,
big if, Greg said.
Yeah, and I'll bet he'd be real glad to see us, too, seeing as how he's come back to rescue us and all,
Prue added sourly.
No matter where we go, you're talking 40 kids,
Greg said. We'd need wagons, food, ammo, horses, all stuff we don't have.
If we take everyone,
Sarah said,
maybe we don't.
Oh?
Prue raised an eyebrow.
You got someone you want to kick off the island?
Yes. Aiden, Lucian, and Sam.
Sarah leveled a look.
I don't trust them.
Prue shrugged.
I'm okay with that.
Wait. I don't know if it should be that simple, Greg said. We're not choosing teams for a pickup game. Sure, I don't like what they do, but I don't have any better ideas.
You guys could not do it,
Tori put in.
Just because Peter decided torture was okay doesn't mean it is. Won't a prisoner say anything so you'll stop hurting him?
Hey, that's not fair, Prue said. Council had to approve, too.
Which most of us didn't know about until Chris ran. So if torture was so okay, why hide it?
Tori's attention stayed on Greg.
What would happen if you refused?
I don't know.
Greg didn't want to find out. It would be like telling the principal he was doing a sucky job. Gee, thanks for your opinion, kid, and that'll be detention for the rest of your life. Look how easily Jaeger decided to throw Chris into the prison house, and Chris was his grandson. He stood.
We gotta go.
Can we just not decide on who until we figure out how or if we should do this now? It's still winter, for God's sake.
Not for much longer. We need to decide, and soon.
When Greg only bent to zip his parka, Sarah continued,
Look, if you're not with us, fine, but stay out of our way.
What? Greg snapped.
Sarah, in case you haven't noticed, I'm not the enemy.
She's just upset,
Tori said.
I'm not?
Don't make excuses for her.
But don't you see, Greg? It's all coming down.
Sarah's eyes brimmed.
Peter's dead and Chris is gone and it's all falling apart.
And you think I don't know that?
The red blaze of sudden anger was acid on his tongue.
Let me tell you about falling apart. Peter was my friend. The only reason I didn't die in that ambush is because I went to Orin with Chris. There isn't a day goes by I don't think about how maybe I could have saved Peter. And what about Chris? He trusted me. If Chris had asked, I'd have helped him get out. But he didn't, and he's gone. Now when there are decisions the council wants enforced, they come to me. And you know what I get to do now? Boost some old people on a rumor that they got a couple spare gerbils lying around. So don't tell me how things fall apart, Sarah. He yanked his zipper so hard the metal should have sparked. Been there, done that, bought the goddamn T-shirt.
Tori caught up as he and Prue were halfway down the nave.
She's just upset.
A lot of that going around, Prue said. Don't worry about it, Greg said, still angry. No big deal.
Yes, it is. Look, I... Tori's eyes flickered to Prue and then back. Can we just talk a sec?
Sure. Greg looked over at Prue, who only hunched a shoulder and headed for the altar, hung a left, and ducked through an arched entry. Greg waited until he heard the clump of Prue's boots on the steps, then turned back to Tori. Yeah?
I didn't mean to give you a hard time, she said, giving his arm a light squeeze. I'm glad the council picked you to take Chris's place, and not Prue.
Oh. His mouth dried up. Tori had never touched him before. No girl had. How strange was this, to be standing in a church with a girl he was majorly crushing on, and he was armed?
I don't... He muzzled a cough. It's not like I had a lot of choice.
Tori's eyes were very blue, but that could have been because she was standing even closer than before.
You could have said no, but you didn't. It's easy for people to complain, like how I always got on my mom's case when she wouldn't let me stay up late.
Tori's mouth moved in a smile so sad, Greg had this weird impulse to cup her cheek the way his mom used to when he had a bad fever.
Now that we have all these little kids, I understand where she was coming from.
Most days I'd give anything for my mom to nag about homework or put away the Xbox. I don't think she'd even recognize me anymore.
She'd recognize you. You're doing the best you can.
But what if it isn't my best?
Then figure it out, she said,
and before he knew what was happening, her mouth was on his. Greg was so startled he gasped. His heart began to bang, and he thought he might faint. This felt so good. He didn't know what to do with his hands, couldn't catch his breath, wasn't really thinking anymore. They came up for air at the same moment, and he said, "Tori, shh," she said. So they stopped talking for a while, and that was fine. That was good. At least there were a couple moments where Greg didn't have to think about what a terrible person he was, heading out to kill some grandma's poor old cat. Chapter 41 An hour later.
Go rest,
Tori whispered, laying a light hand on Sarah's shoulder.
I'll sit with Caleb. No, it's all right.
Sarah tried to smile, but her muscles felt frozen, a feeling that reminded her of when her dad repaired their driveway and she tested just how long you could stick your sneaker into wet cement. A million years from now, an archaeologist would discover a little pink sneaker and wonder where the rest of the body was.
What's so funny? Huh?
Sarah actually had to put a hand to her face. Her lips were so stiff they would have been at home on a corpse.
Nothing. I was just remembering something.
By her feet, she felt Jet whimper. Normally calm, Jet had been restless ever since Greg and Prue left.
I'm sorry about earlier with Greg. It wasn't fair.
No, it wasn't. Tori draped a moist cloth over the little boy's forehead.
You've got to stop this self-pity crap. We all miss Peter.
I keep expecting Chris to walk in any second.
To rescue us?
She marveled at how easily the bitterness oozed back. When had she gotten so mean? All this moaning and woe is me. Still whining, Jet had clambered to his feet. She ruffled his ears to quiet the animal and herself down.
I'm sorry. That was nasty. I just can't seem to find a balance, like I'm on this emotional teeter-totter. You're not the only person having a hard time. Greg is trying, and he's got feelings to hurt. You think I'm always so cheerful and understanding? Most of the time I'm faking it. Otherwise I'd spend half the day crying and the other half daydreaming about food I can't have. I'm going to be 18 in 2 months. I should be thinking about college and driving my mom crazy, and if I'll be a blimp in a prom dress.
Tori squeezed out a small, bleak laugh.
Wish my mom could see me. She was always on me about my weight. So were you faking it before? Talking about getting away, I mean?
No.
We better do it soon. Prue's right. You can feel it in the air, how angry everyone is. The food went so fast, and so did the rest of the supplies.
We've got plenty of guns, but no bullets, and no game left to hunt anyway. We'll be lucky the council doesn't get lynched. Things are starting to get out of control.
Tori paused.
Remember I mentioned unlocking the choir door? What I didn't say was Cutter was waiting right outside, hours before he was scheduled to show.
What?
Of their two night guards, she most disliked the shaggy, thick-set old man who'd wandered into rule with Lang and Weller. Other oldsters darted a quick glance, but Cutter actually stared.
Why didn't you say anything?
Because he didn't exactly do anything. He pretended he needed to check the door. You know how small that landing is?
She did. The stairs were narrow, meant for the choir to access the chancel. The landing between the basement and sanctuary was a square no larger than a couple doormats placed side by side.
Did he, you know...
She didn't want to say, touch you.
Pretty much. He was inside so fast he copped a pretty good feel. His face was dangerous, like I'd better not scream or fight. You really think he would have hurt you? I honestly didn't want to find out. But they were the littler kids, and I thought all of a sudden, well, better me than one of them. How sick is that? That's not sick. You were protecting the kids.
Sarah took Tori's chilled hands in hers.
Something else happened, though, I can tell. What was it?
He said that if I didn't want Prue or Greg to end up in trouble, I might want to be nice. So I let him get in a good, long, dirty little grope.
When Sarah pulled in a breath, Tori said, "Don't, okay? I already feel like I've crawled through a sewer.
But you know those beans Prue gave him? Cutter offered the can to me, like payment. He said he didn't expect something for nothing, that the kids might like more food if I would, you know, do more. And what's horrible?"
Tori's eyes dropped to her lap.
For a second I thought, okay. Tori?
Sarah could taste the acid boil from her empty stomach.
You don't mean that.
I don't know.
Tori gave a hopeless shrug.
Maybe I do. The kids are hungry. And what if Cutter threatens to hurt Greg or Prue? None of us are safe.
Look, let's just take a step back, okay? Nothing's happened yet. We'll talk to Greg and Prue. We'll think of something. Know what? I'd like some tea. Want tea?
Sarah stood up so quickly her heart couldn't keep up, and a sweep of vertigo blacked her vision. She gulped back a shaky breath, then another.
You want chamomile or chamomile? Chamomile'd be great.
Tori managed a wobbly smile.
Look, I already put Daisy and Ghost with the girls. Would you drop off Jet with the boys? That dog goes crazy when you're not around.
Not as crazy as I feel right now.
Sure.
She turned to go, Jet on her heels.
It'll be okay, Tori.
It's nice, Tori said, that you think so.
God, the thought of Cutter hitting on Tori. Sarah shuddered as she walked the breezeway connecting the school to the church. The idea made her want to take a cup of bleach to her brain and hit rinse. The thought of his creepy old hands on her, or his mouth.
Gag me with a fork.
Frosty air palmed her face as she pushed through double doors and into the west vestibule. Directly ahead were two sets of stairs. Bare left, and you had a choice, either up three steps to a cloakroom or down 12 to the basement. Choose the right set of steps, however, and you accessed a circular stone stair coiling up to the bell tower. She flicked on a flashlight and took the left stairs. The church was not her favorite place. The place creeped her out day or night. Constructed entirely of off-white native limestone, the church was a soundproofed ice cube that held onto a deep gloom and a stone-cold chill. Following her light, she descended into the midnight gloaming of the windowless basement. Grit crackled like cap guns under her shoes. The gelid air was fiery on her skin. The basement was dominated by the inky cave of a common room that seemed only blacker with the cold. Shivering, she hung a left for the kitchen, a long, narrow throat of a room designed on the cheap. The cupboards were puke-yellow vintage plywood.
The floor and counters were stained formica. The industrial-sized stainless steel sink sported two spigots, not that she'd ever known water to run from either. All their water came from snowmelt, and they always kept an aluminum camp pot with a plug of ice at the ready. It was when she fumbled out a match that she heard it, a very small but crisp crunch, like sand under a heavy boot.
What?
Her heart cramped. She went completely still, unlit match in hand, then eased right to peer down the long throat of the kitchen's one aisle and toward a closed storage room where they kept their meager rations under lock and key. As her weight shifted, she caught the snap and crackle again, grit under her feet.
You heard yourself, silly.
Touching off the Coleman, she squared the pot of ice over the burner.
Just freaking yourself out.
Shaking out her keys, she walked to the storage room, socked in a key, turned it, and heard the thunk as the lock didn't release but engaged.
Huh?
She frowned.
The door was open?
That wasn't right. Then she recalled what Tori said.
When I went to sweep out the basement...
Tori had used the chore as an excuse to open the side door so Greg and Prue could slip inside.
But now there's sand.
She thought about how much colder the vestibule seemed, and her pulse ramped just a little higher. Always icy, the church had been frigid because the side door was open. Would she know? No, not if she didn't stop to check or feel a draft.
And the basement's freezing, which follows because if the door is open, the air has two ways to go. Up into the sanctuary...
or down here, into the basement, with her.
But hold on, hold on.
Tori had gone after Greg. Had she mentioned locking up once the boys left? Sarah hadn't asked. It wasn't something she'd have checked anyway, because Tori had enough common sense to realize that you always locked doors.
Even if she did lock it, something could have come in earlier and be here now.
No, that was silly. Why hang out in a frigid basement? What was here that was nowhere else?
Well, food, duh.
And that made her think of something else, Tori said. When she opened the side door, Cutter had been there.
Oh, God.
What if Tori had jumped to the wrong conclusion? Cutter had keys.
So maybe he was really there to steal food. A spoonful of peanut butter here, a few crackers there. Who's to know?
It wasn't like they counted every bean. Maybe she should just get out of here and close off the basement. Yeah, but that meant going through that dark, spooky common room to the stairs. From there, the only way out was through the side door, or the chancel the next flight up. So maybe best to retrace her steps, make a beeline back for the school, and then the girls could lock themselves in.
If something came after them... Tori has the shotgun, I've got the pistol.
But she wasn't good with guns, didn't like them.
Fine, don't fight the boogeyman.
Lock the doors, open a window, and scream. If anyone heard them. It was late afternoon, slipping into early evening. Not a lot of people moved around these days, if they could help it. Very little food meant very little energy. The sound came again, and it was harsher this time, not merely a pop and crack, but a scuff like a heavy boot. That was when she knew. There wasn't something lurking in the storage room. There was something behind her, spiriting out of the black well of the common room, coming right for her. Chapter 42. Don't! Greg wedged his boot between the door and jamb. Don't make this tougher than it has to be.
But you've made a mistake.
From what Greg could see through the crack, one glittery bat's eye far back in the cave of her socket, Verna Landry looked as if she'd have to stand twice to throw a shadow.
I don't know who told you.
Well, we can talk about that, he said, trying to inject notes of both sympathy and steel. A cat. I'm harassing this poor woman over a cat. It was always a toss-up, trying to decide how many guys to take, and whether they should be really, really ancient or just normal old. This time he'd opted for six, with four spared, him, Prue, Aiden, and Lucian, and two geezers, a really ancient denture sucker with a bugle of a voice named Henry, and Jarvis, who was just plain old and knew the woman's husband, Chester. "I really need you to open the door, Mrs. Landry. This is my house. You have no right to come here making accusations." That single gimlet eye clicked right. "Jarvis, you took all our food 7 weeks ago." "Well, Verna, see, that's the problem." A pallid geezer, Jarvis had the kind of knobby neck Greg always associated with a turkey, but he was one tough old bird. "Chester kept going on about how he got runs eating cat food. It was a ration." "No one's giving out cat food to people." Lucian skimmed that serpent's tongue over his lips. His silver stud winked. "Cats, maybe," Lucian drawled, "but not cat food." Beside him, Aiden sniggered and blocked off a nostril with his thumb, let out a juicy honk, did a quick peek, then wiped his hand on his jeans. "That all goes to the dogs," Greg said, unsure if he only wanted to kick Lucian in the teeth or never touch anything Aiden got near again, maybe both. "So where did Chester get it?"
"Fine," Verna's voice ratcheted up a notch. "Fine. Yes, we had a cat. It was Lisa's, but it ran away once she..."
Verna petered out, then revved up again.
"We still had the food."
"Then you should have turned that in last time we did a door-to-door."
Prue moved a little closer and said, "Council gave orders right after the ambush."
"All right, we made a mistake. But did you find a cat then?" "No. And why pick on cats? Why not dogs and horses?"
This was why Greg had left Daisy with Tori and Sarah. All they needed was a pissed-off villager taking a potshot. "Please, ma'am, this'll go a lot easier if you just open the door."
"Not until Chester gets home. You'll just have to come back when he..."
"Do it." Greg was suddenly just so sick of the whole thing. Let them just get in, get out, get this over with so he could go back to Tori.
"Playing our song," Aiden said.
Moving in a swift sidestep around Greg, he and Lucian pistoned quick, cop-style kicks. The old woman saw them coming, let out an abortive squawk, but didn't move fast enough. There was a splintering scream as both the lock plate and chain popped free of the jam. Greg heard a sickening thuck and an ugh as the old woman's head first connected with wood, then snapped on the spindle of her neck. Lurching back, a hand clapped to her streaming nose, she began a stuffy screech.
"Manu! Manu!"
"Lucky it's still attached," Aiden said.
"Fucking A," Lucian said, though whether he was agreeing or commenting on his friend's prowess at breaking an old woman's nose, Greg didn't know and didn't care.
"Henry, make sure she doesn't go anywhere," Greg said, stepping over the blubbering old woman as Henry doddered up and piped on an improbably high note.
"Now, Verna, I could have told you."
"Man, I hate this."
Striding past an understairs closet, Greg moved down the hall, darkened now with late afternoon gloom, and toward the kitchen with Prue and Jarvis on his heels. For no particular reason, his scalp suddenly tingled, and a maddening itch dug at the back of his neck.
Whoa, something wrong here.
He had this very weird sense that the house was both empty and yet occupied. He shot a glance over his shoulder. Aiden and Lucian were sauntering, their eyes roaming over walls of photographs, tables cluttered with bric-a-brac, ready to liberate anything they took a fancy to the second Greg or Prue or Jarvis might not be looking. He watched Aiden open that understairs closet, peek, then move on. Nothing really untoward. He frowned.
"So why am I so spooked? Something wrong."
"Bingo! Food dish!"
Prue chinned a cheery yellow placemat tucked into a corner of the kitchen behind a farmhouse table and chairs, a round ceramic bowl decorated with fish skeletons and the words meow and yum yum squatted next to an aluminum water bowl which was half full. The food dish held a single kibble.
"I don't see a litter box."
"Maybe they let it out," Aiden said.
"Might still be out unless the old geezer run off."
"Hey," Greg said, uncomfortably aware of Jarvis, who fit the definition of both old and geezer. Aiden really needed to watch his mouth.
"Just keep it zipped, okay?"
"What?"
Aiden managed to look confused.
"What'd I say?"
"Nothing, kid," Jarvis said, laying it on thick, then looked at Greg. "Chester wouldn't run. And that fuss Verna put up? 10-1, that cat's still here."
"Maybe they shoved it into a closet or something."
Spying a corner pantry, Greg pulled the door. The pantry was completely enclosed and pitch black. Pulling out his flashlight, Greg sprayed orange light over the pine floor. "Got a bag of dry, couple cans of wet..."
"What?"
Aiden and Lucian both asked when Greg trailed off.
"Hang on."
The wood floors of the old house were none too clean, but with so little traffic here, the pine was much lighter, and he spotted one board that looked scuffed, its seams wider than the rest, like it's been replaced or popped. When he pushed, the board rocked. Oh, boy. He was afraid to hope, but his heart drummed just a little faster. We might have something here. We might really... Flicking open his pocket knife, he worked the tip into a seam. The blade passed through easily. "Hey," he called. As the others crowded in the doorway, he pointed. "This board's been pried. I can't get enough leverage to pop it, though. Here." Lucian pulled a black carbon steel machete that probably could carve a buffalo from his waist sheath.
"Try this."
Working the blade, Greg eased it a good 8 inches through the gap before the steel ticked.
"Metal?"
"Got something."
"Sure you don't got just a joist?"
Prue asked. "It's not wood. I can feel a draft. I think this is a crawl space under the house." Another 5 seconds, and Greg popped the board, stared, then said, "Oh, holy shit." In the cone of orange light thrown by his flashlight into this hidey hole, the jars sparkled like a hoard of rare gems. Small, beveled glass jars of strawberry jelly, deep orange marmalade, blueberry jelly. Larger pint and glittering quart mason jars packed full of pickled carrots, asparagus spears, mushrooms, potatoes, and other vegetables, as well as fruits.
"Whoa," Lucian said, and Aiden added, "Oh, fuck me. Jesus Christ."
Jarvis said it like a prayer. Crowding in, he reached past Greg and withdrew a quart of tightly packed fruit swimming in clear syrup. In the light, the peaches looked like golden half-moons.
"They've got all this food. They've got food. Gooseberries."
Greg read on another jar, the word done in delicate, precise letters, along with a date. He'd never tasted gooseberries, but they sounded deliriously good. His stomach was moaning, and there was so much saliva pooling under his tongue he was afraid he'd start drooling.
Apricots. Cherries.
To distract himself, he counted jars. 36. Not huge, but
hell with huge.
Jarvis had folded that quart of peaches to his chest, the way Reverend Yeager sometimes clutched his Bible during a sermon.
"I should have thought of this. I've known Verna since we were kids, going on 60 years now. Her mom canned like crazy all summer and fall. We searched here 6 weeks ago, bare as a bone, and I thought how strange that was. Not like Verna at all. But it had been months since everything went to hell, and I thought, okay, they ate it all."
Jarvis's face suddenly darkened.
"And they've still been taking rations."
"Assholes," Aiden said.
"Yeah, that isn't right. It's not, you know, fair,"
Lucian put in.
"But I don't get it."
Prue was examining a jar of bright purple eggs pickled in beet juice. Greg bet if anyone had suggested eating something like that to Prue 5 months ago, he'd have told you to get real.
"Why does that old lady look like she's starving?"
Prue asked.
"Maybe this is their emergency stash,"
Lucian suggested.
"Or they've been eating only a little bit here and there."
Aiden hefted a jar of pickled Brussels sprouts.
"Man, I used to hate this shit. But now, no problem. We got to tear up the rest of the house. We ought to tear up all the houses. X them off."
"Wait, wait, not so fast."
Greg was getting dizzy. The urge to crack the seal of that jar of cherries was nearly overwhelming.
"This is cool, but we came for the cat." "What am I saying? Screw the cat."
Lucian fished out a mason jar swimming with ruby red plums.
"Man, we could don't even think about it."
Greg replaced the cherries, although letting go took effort. Come on, hand them over.
Hold on.
Lucian cocked his elbow, holding his jar out of reach, leaving Greg with air. Don't we gotta say? No. Greg's stomach fluttered. From the nod of frustration on Prue's face, he wasn't sure this wouldn't end up being 4-1, maybe even 5 if you counted doddering old Henry.
Listen, I understand, but we can't. It's not fair to everyone else.
Fuck fair! In the gloom, Aiden's tats looked like bugs that had chewed their way out of his cheeks.
Dude, I'm hungry. We keep quiet, no one has to know.
Old woman'll know, Lucian rumbled. We can do something about that, Aiden said.
No, Greg repeated. The only thing we're doing is turning this stuff in.
What if I don't? Aiden said.
You can't make me.
The words were so like a 5-year-old's, Greg had to bite his cheek.
Just get one of them to hand over a jar. We can't go there. Come on, guys.
He held out his hands to Prue, who he thought would relent first. Hand it over. After what seemed a very long second, Prue pushed the jar into Greg's hands.
Here, Prue said, take the damn thing before I accidentally break it on purpose.
Slotting the jar back, Greg tilted his head toward Aiden and Lucian.
You too. You know the rules. We share food. That's the way it has to be.
Aiden's head swiveled to Lucian, whose shark eyes ticked to Prue and then back, weighing the options. A moment later, Lucian shrugged and silently passed over his jar.
Fuck!
Aiden tossed his Brussels sprouts in an underhand pitch that Greg fumbled and nearly dropped.
Asshole! Hope you fucking choke!
Jarvis? Heart banging, Greg looked up at the old man.
Come on! It's a jar of peaches.
Jarvis's tongue flickered over his lips.
No one has to know. I'm with you, brother, Aiden put in. I'm 75 years old, Jarvis said, and then his face nodded. Council cares more about you. Spared, eat better. You get it all. Hey, fuck that, Jarvis, Lucian said. I'm scraping empty.
Yeah, Prue chimed in.
We spared are doing so great. All I'm asking for is a lousy jar of peaches, for God's sake,
Jarvis said.
Jarvis.
Greg swallowed around the stone in his throat.
We're all hungry, but you know the rules.
Rules?
Jarvis's eyes narrowed. Real easy for you when the rules break your way. Guess that's what comes with being the council's private pets.
Whoa, who are you calling a pet? Aiden said.
We gave up our food too, you know.
Yeah, but why?
Jarvis rifled a glare at Greg. Because the council gives you the authority? Here, we've supported them for years. We gave up our own grandkids. We let them get rounded up and shot without ever being given the chance to get better. Come back to us. And now we're supposed to starve, too, to save you? Kids that aren't our blood? Not our family? Hell with that. Okay, wait.
Prue put his hands up, palms out.
Let's all just cool off, okay? What if I don't want to cool off?
Jarvis's eyes hadn't left Greg.
What if I'm done taking orders from the council? From punks?
Hey! Lucian's forehead furrowed so deeply the scabs on the dome of his skull bunched.
Watch the punk shit!
The pantry was suddenly very cramped and much too dark, and he'd left his rifle in the kitchen. So had Jarvis, but he also carried a pistol in a paddle holster. Greg flicked a glance to the old man's waist, then wished he hadn't given himself away like that. Jarvis read the move.
Afraid I'm going to take a shot?
Before Greg could think of the right answer, was there one? Prue said,
Seeing as how I'm right behind you, Jarvis, that would be a real bad idea. You got a Ruger, kid?
Jarvis cracked a laugh. His Adam's apple wobbled in his turkey neck.
Punch right through. Blast me, you blast him.
There was the sound of metal sliding over plastic, and then Greg saw Jarvis's back stiffen.
Yeah, but this don't have bullets,
Aiden said, and he must have pressed the tip of his knife just a touch more into Jarvis's neck, because the old man gasped.
I did this once in bio to this big honking bullfrog.
I remember that lab, Lucian said.
Kind of a rush, the way the frog spazzed.
No one's pithing frogs, and no one's blasting anyone. Now, I'm just picking up Lucian's knife here, okay? Everyone be cool.
Slowly unfolding himself from the floor, Greg raised his right palm out while he held the machete's blade in his left and prayed Lucian didn't grab it so quickly he lost a few fingers in the bargain. Beyond, he could see Prue, his Ruger Mini 14, holding steady on the back of Jarvis's head, and Aiden, whose lips were drawn into a predatory grin Greg knew all too well. Lucian only looked thoughtful, like all the gears were clicking away in there, all the angles being considered. That was somehow even scarier.
"Here's what we're going to do."
His jaw was so tight, Greg could barely get the words past his teeth.
"Screw the cat, okay? We pack up the stuff, and then we all leave together. We take everything to the food stores, and then we don't have to worry about it anymore. All right?"
"Out of sight, out of mind?"
Jarvis gave a bitter cackle like the snap of bad ice. Didn't sound or look much like a gobble-gobble now.
"You think it's that easy?" "Hey!" Aiden's teeth showed in a snarl. "You threatening us, poor little punks?"
"Aiden, put the knife away." Greg's eyes slid to Prue.
"You too."
After a long second, Prue's elbows broke, and Greg heard the click of the Ruger's safety. "Aiden?" Greg said again.
"Yeah, yeah,"
Aiden said, but from the way Jarvis's cheek twitched, Greg thought the little rat creep still managed to cut.
"Okay,"
Greg said. "We need something to carry this stuff. Prue, you and Jarvis go look for some pillowcases."
"How do we know you won't slip a jar into your pocket or saddlebags while we're gone?" Jarvis said. "Why should we trust you?"
"Because you can."
"Jarvis, really, we're on the same side," Greg said. "Yeah?" Jarvis said. "Which side is that?"
Chapter 43.
"Move!"
The fine down on Sarah's neck bristled with an electrical surge of terror.
"Something coming. Move, move."
"No!" Gasping, she bolted like a spooked rabbit, springing for the storage room door, keys tinkling to the formica, but no time to search for them, just enough to get away. The door crashed open with an enormous bang. As Sarah bulleted through, she felt fingers whisking through her hair. With a wild yelp, she spun on her heel and lunged for the door to clap it shut. Her flashlight jittered crazily, ripping wide gashes, cutting shelves out of the dark before she lost her grip. The light clattered to the floor, the orange spray winking out. Blind now, she swam through the dark, made a wild grab, felt the bite of wood, and then she was muscling the door home with a solid clap. Safe. She was safe. Chest heaving, she leaned back, bracing the door with her body, expecting to feel the thud. But nothing happened. No bang, no battering of a fist, no kicks. Barricade the door. Without the keys, she couldn't lock it, and this might be her only chance. She knew the storage area well enough to navigate in the dark, freestanding, largely barren metal shelves right and left. The only shelves with any food at all were on her left. So grab a shelf off to her right, haul it in front of the door, unless she'd imagined the whole thing. She pulled in a screaming breath, held it, listened over the clamor of her heart. The air smelled very faintly of peanut butter, but she heard nothing. So, nerves? No, she'd felt something grab for her hair, unless that had been a phantom terror, too. Felt so real. Maybe only her mind playing tricks. Because I'm stressed, starved, exhausted. What to do now was the question. She could stay here, barricade the door, but the Coleman was on. Eventually, the ice would melt, boil off. Forget the waste of fuel. The flame would burn a hole through that pot, and then they'd have a fire. She listened again, pressing her ear against the keyhole. Still nothing. If she decided to leave, go back out there, she would need light, which meant retrieving her flashlight from the floor and hoping to God that it worked. Sarah dropped to her hands and knees, grit bit through her jeans. Okay, which way? She'd been spinning for the door when she'd lost the flashlight. From the sound the metal tube made as it struck the floor and then rolled, she thought it might be ahead at roughly 10 o'clock. Moving carefully, she swept her trembling right hand over the cold floor.
She kept expecting something to skitter across her skin. A spider, maybe. But no self-respecting spider would set up shop here, and it was too cold besides. Her fingers skimmed more dirt, a lot of it. And that was so strange, because Tori was such a stickler about neatness. But Cutter had interrupted Tori this afternoon, so she might not have swept here at all. Sarah inched forward, her hand moving back and forth like a metal detector for what seemed like an hour, but which was likely no more than a minute, before her fingers nudged a curve of cool metal that tried rolling away. The flashlight. Snatching it up, she rocked back on her knees, let out a long sigh of relief, and butted her thumb against the metal switch. A cone of yellow light leapt away, spraying itself against the darkness to reveal bare metal, cinder block, and... No! The word jumped from Sarah's throat as huge hands shot from the dark. One battened on her jaw, clamping down on her mouth. The other jumped into her hair, fisted and yanked as if pulling a long cord. Her head whipped back, exposing her throat, and then she was tottering, her balance gone. She crashed to the ice-cold floor, legs kinked at an excruciating angle, the impact smacking the breath from her lungs. Terrified, wild not only with fear but the need to breathe, she flailed, the flashlight she still clutched whipping around. She felt when it clubbed bone, the solid thunk shuddering in her hand. From the hulking dark above her came a strangled grunt, a deep and guttural ugh. The hand in her hair jerked like a fish trying to flip from a net, then groped for her thrashing wrist, found it, ground down. An enormous bolt of pain shot up to her elbow, and she relaxed her grip. The flashlight tumbled to the floor again. This time, however, the light did not wink out, which wasn't necessarily a mercy. Quiet! Cutter snarled. Dropping onto her chest, he brought his face so close his spit sprayed her cheeks. Sweeping up both her arms, he grabbed her wrists in one hand and pinned them to the floor. Be quiet, unless you want me to snap your little neck right now. She wasn't screaming. She had no breath for that. Shaking her head wildly from side to side, she strained, her tortured lungs singing, the blood booming in her temples. Breathing was like trying to butt a mountain out of the way with her chest. She managed another suck of air, her nose wrinkling against a weird perfume, souring Cutter's flesh, oily onions, greasy sweat, and peanut butter. If she could have opened her mouth, she'd have bitten him. Get off! You gonna scream? When she shook her head, he eased his hand away. We need to have ourselves a little talk.
There's nothing to talk about, she stammered. She was stealing food from the little kids!
Cutter's eyes flattened.
I'm taking my share. I'm taking what's mine.
You get rations?
By now, Tori must be wondering. She'd come down to check, probably with one of the dogs, too. Even if she didn't, Tori had that shotgun. If she could keep Cutter talking. God, where was their other guard, Benton? Unless he was in on this, too.
We're all on rations.
But you kids get more. They save the best for you.
Cutter sported a full, gnarled gray wire of beard, so dense there might be things living very comfortably in there.
We take all the risks, and we're supposed to be grateful for a cup of watered-down tomato soup.
Please, just let me go. I won't say anything.
For some reason, her eyes zeroed in on a glop of peanut butter clinging to a tangle at the left corner of his mouth. In the bad light, the smear looked like a rat turd.
You can have my rations. You can just have them.
Yeah? Well, what if I want more?
He drew the word out, his voice in her ear again, his reeking breath hot on her neck, and yet she never had felt so cold in her life. Her heart tried dying in her chest.
I don't have anything else. Please, just... I won't tell anyone, I promise.
Who you going to tell? The council? Your boyfriend, that Prue? What if I was to tell how some kid thinks he can buy me off with a measly can of beans? You think people might be interested in why those boys come to pass the time with such pretty girls? And here that Peter only 7 weeks in his grave, and you already finding someone to warm you up.
No, I...
Her tongue clung to the roof of her mouth.
It's not what you think.
Oh, I got a good imagination. So, you like Prue?
He drawled the word, his voice lazy, even as she became aware of the increased grind of his hips.
You like what he does?
No, he's just... She strained against Cutter's weight. Please, let me go! Let me...
Here's what I want.
His mouth, the lips thick and cold and moist as worms, dragged over her throat.
I want you to be as sweet to me as you've been to that Prue.
No! She was gasping again, trying to hold back tears. Please, I'll scream!
You scream, and I'll tell how those boys were here. And it won't matter what you're up to, how nice Prue is. They'll be watched. But you don't want them anyway. You want a man, and I can be nice.
His hips jerked in a sudden hard thrust, his breath suddenly clogging as he worked his knee between her legs.
I can be sweet to a sweet thing.
In the next moment, she felt his body lift, his free hand dropping and then fumbling at her waist. She let out a short, sharp cry. No! No! His mouth clamped on hers, and she gagged as he worked his thick tongue between her lips and licked her teeth. Bucking, she tried to bite, but he wrapped his free hand around her throat and rapped her head so hard that all the circuitry shorted.
You like it rough?
His voice was ragged, his face choked with blood.
I'll show you rough. I'll show you what a man...
She heard a loud bang, an explosion of wood against cinderblock. In her terror, she thought it was her mind snapping. Hadn't they talked about that in health, how the brain could let go, be elsewhere, hide? But then she felt Cutter rear in surprise, saw his eyes go wide with shock, and thought, Tori! Jesus! Cutter started up. Something, someone, hurtled over her head, slamming the still shrilling Cutter to his back. Whatever this was, darted its head once like a snake striking at prey. There was a loud tearing sound, a ripping of wet cloth, and then Cutter was only thrashing, gurgling, both hands trying to staunch sudden pulsing red jets from a throat that was no longer there. His blood hit concrete in hard, frantic splashes. The changed, a boy, rode him, but only for a second. What happened next nearly splintered her mind. Planting a hand on Cutter's forehead, the changed plunged a clawed hand straight down into Cutter's throat. Sarah couldn't see Cutter's face, but the old man's legs stiffened, his boots jerking as if he'd been electrocuted. The boy's back tensed, and there came another of those loud, wet-cloth rips. Cutter was still juddering in his death dance as the changed sank his teeth into a limp red tube of steaming flesh. On the floor, Sarah began to scream. Chapter 44. Reining in his horse at the village hall, a hulking two-story brownstone capped with a clock tower, Greg dismounted. Tethering his mare to a wrought-iron railing, he untied a bulging navy blue pillowcase from his saddle. The contents ticked, glass against glass, as he hefted the makeshift sack over his left shoulder. It had taken them a long time to both search the rest of the house and then pack up the stash, which the stuffy-nosed, still-bleeding Verna assured them was the very last of what they'd squirreled away. Chester still hadn't shown by the time they left. Neither had the cat. By then, Greg didn't care. His only concern was getting the jars out of his hands, out of his sight, then finding someplace quiet to lie down and screw food. He passed a hand over his suddenly watering eyes, wincing at a needle of pain, jabbing his temples. Another whopper of a migraine muttering in there, building itself up to a real roar, the kind of monster headache that made him queasy and fractured his sight with wavering lines and jagged shards of light. Kincaid said that was normal, called it scintillating something or other, and doled out some advice, too.
Reduce your stress, son, and you might feel better.
Oh, yeah, right. What had happened back at the Landrys was just too damned close for comfort. No matter what Tori said, and yes, kissing her was the best thing that had happened to him in months, he knew it was all bullshit, too. Maybe she believes in me, but I sure don't. That fiasco back there only proved he wasn't Chris or Peter. No good pretending he could be either anymore, no matter what the council said or wanted. If Aiden had rebelled, or Prue had sided with Jarvis, or Jarvis had taken a shot, what then? Kill Jarvis?
Shoot anyone else who disobeyed, or make the exception and look the other way as the guys cracked open those jars and ate the evidence. Hell, he might have joined in. Can't even trust myself. Got to go to the council in the morning and just quit. Tell them Prue's a better choice. He's older, and he thinks things through better than me. And really, what could the council do? Send him to the principal's office? Ban him? His lips curled in a sour smile. Not likely. He wasn't refusing to help. There were patrols to mount, places to guard, the occasional foraging expedition. He'd settle for chopping wood. Plenty to do. Besides, he was spared woo-hoo and way too valuable to toss. I'll trade valuable for normal any day. He skimmed a look toward the church. His mind drifted back to the shock of Tori's mouth. How nice that felt, and warm. For those few seconds, he'd actually felt human again. So maybe after we're done here, sneak back to the church. It'll be dark soon. Lob a snowball at her window, and then, what you grinning about? It was Prue, 2 steps below. Nothing. God, he couldn't even daydream in peace. Another scintillating splinter of light skewered his left eye. He ought to see Kincaid, maybe beg some aspirin or Tylenol, if there was any left. Or maybe in all Kincaid's reading up on plants and mushrooms, tinkering with decoctions and infusions, he'd come up with something that could deal with this monster headache that just wouldn't quit. "Come on," he said, turning, his gaze sweeping past the church. "Let's..." Suddenly he froze. Prue let a beat slide by.
"Greg?"
He didn't reply. He could feel his eyebrows bunching together in a sudden frown. Out of the corner of his eye, he could have sworn there'd been a light. No, a flash. But that was probably the headache.
Greg?
I don't know, he said to Prue, but I thought I heard something. Chapter 45. From what Sarah could see, Cutter wasn't quite done dying yet. His fingers fluttered and flapped like dying starfish. The close air in this back storage room was saturated, almost fogged, with the heady stink of wet pennies. Hunched over the body, both hands full of Cutter's meat, the changed was feeding with a single-minded ferocity that reminded Sarah of a film they'd seen in Science about wolves, how a pack brought down a full-grown moose. Once the animal was on the snow, the wolves ripped open the abdomen and literally ate the moose to death.
Starving.
Horrified, Sarah watched the boy's Adam's apple bob in a swallow as he simultaneously crammed in another mouthful. The boy had one of the worst cases of acne she'd ever seen. His face looked broken and bruised. With all that blood smeared over pitted skin and bulging sacks of yellow pus, the changed looked diseased, something out of The Walking Dead.
She had to get out of here.
Clawing to her feet, she lurched in a stumble stagger that sent her crashing into the door. At the sound, the change twisted, seemed to see her for the first time, and began to surge up from the floor. Turning, she blundered down the narrow alley of the kitchen, banging like an errant pinball between counters. With no flashlight, she was blind, driving forward on memory and fear. As she crashed through the dark, she felt a sudden, slight change in temperature, a puff of even colder air from the common room. Wheeling drunkenly to the right, she groped, found the corner, and then she was half falling, half sprinting up the stairs. Her ears caught a thump behind and below, a steady, fast clump of boots coming for her. Not much time. Even starving, the changed boy was faster. Sarah tore a screaming breath from the air, and then another. Above, she could see the slight gray-green glow of the vestibule. Once she made it up and then out of there and into the breezeway, if she could just make it to the doors, lock him out of the school. My keys! A moan fell out of her mouth. Her keys were behind her on the floor. She doubted she was fast enough to outdistance this boy anyway. Even if she could, there might be more. Cutter was dead. There was no reason for anyone to check on them until the guards switched off.
And what if someone did notice that the side door was open and came in to investigate? What if that someone was Prue or Greg? This change would be on them in a second. Flinging herself up the last step, she staggered into the vestibule. From below, she could hear the boy's grunts, a stumble as he misjudged the distance between one stair and another. Can't lead him back into the school. Darting right toward the bell tower door, she fumbled for the handle. Please, don't be locked. Mashing down on the icy iron thumb plate, she cocked her elbows, jerked back hard. The door was oak and as solid as any other in the church, but it moved, swinging open with a rusty squall. Cold air spilled, and she saw a shimmery curlicue of narrow stone steps. Bell tower must be open at the top. That's why it's colder and there's light. A sudden gush of air sucked at her back and stoppered her ears. Someone was pushing through from the breezeway into the vestibule, following a cone of orange light that splashed her shadow onto stone. For a crazy moment, she thought the changed had her flashlight, but he was coming from the wrong direction. Then she heard Tori call, "Sarah? Where are you going? What's..." No! Darting a glance left, Sarah saw the boy storming up the last few steps. "Tori, run!" Sarah spun on her heel and waved the other girl back. "Run! Run!" Surging from the dark like a demon summoned from hell, the changed threw himself into the vestibule. Cringing, Tori raised both arms to ward him off. Her flashlight tumbled from her right hand as she unlimbered her shotgun, racked the pump, socked the butt to her shoulder, and in that small span of time, Sarah finally remembered the gun! Sweating, Sarah fumbled for her pistol just as the boy ducked his shoulder, dropped below Tori's line of fire, and sprinted across the vestibule at a dead-on run. Tori let out an explosive, "Ugh!" as the boy smacked into her middle and bore them both crashing to the stone. Somehow, Tori still had the shotgun clutched in her right hand and was trying to bring it around when the boy balled his right fist, still smeary with Cutter's blood, and smashed Tori across the jaw. A yelp jerked from her mouth, her hold on the shotgun loosened, and in one swift, practiced motion, the changed boy swept up the weapon and jammed the muzzle under her chin. "No!" Tori's bloody lips were purple in the yellow glow of the flashlight. "Stop!" Sarah poked the SIG out in both hands, but the gun wavered, and she was shaking so badly her knees wobbled. The changed went rigid, and she thought, "Now shoot him! Shoot!" Gritting her teeth, Sarah squeezed the trigger, and nothing happened. The trigger didn't budge. "The safety!" Tori shrieked. "Sarah, release the..." Too late. Chapter 46.
"Heard what?" asked Prue.
"I don't know. Greg groped for the word. A thump, but so muffled it was more like the sound of a heavy cardboard box on a wood floor.
Sort of a thud. I'm not sure I really heard it."
"Maybe migraines made you hallucinate sounds, too. He didn't remember Kincaid mentioning that."
"I didn't hear anything."
Prue turned to look down at the others clustered at the bottom of the village steps.
"You guys?"
In reply, Jarvis cut Prue a curt shake of his head, while Henry and Lucian only looked blank.
"Man, I can barely hear you,"
Aiden said from the depths of his snorkel.
"Can we, like, go? I'm freezing my ass off."
"Just a sec. Maybe this is all the headache's doing, but..." Puzzled, Greg peered through the gathering twilight at the hunkered edifice of the church, the bony finger of its bell tower stabbing a sky beginning to turn cobalt. From this vantage point, he couldn't see the attached school or the rectory. He stared a long second, saw nothing, then tossed a look opposite at the far end of the square toward a brooding row of shuttered shops and a defunct Christian combination coffee house and bookstore. The storefronts were dark, the black windows empty as sockets. In the center of the square, the snowy mushroom of an octagonal gazebo, probably once used for summer band concerts, huddled beneath a trio of towering oaks. "Thought I saw something, too. This flash. What? Where?" Prue twisted to look right and left, and then behind across the square.
"I don't see anything."
"Me neither,"
the snorkel put in.
"You getting another headache?" Prue asked. "Didn't Kincaid say that might make you see flashes of light and stuff?"
"Yeah." Greg realized his hand had snuck up to pinch the bridge of his nose. "But I could have sworn..." Behind, Greg heard the scrape of a door, and then a guard call,
"Everything okay out here?"
He thought he saw something, Prue said to the guard.
I heard something, too, Greg said.
Yeah? I didn't see anything.
The guard craned a look at his companion, who shook his head and then back. He chinned the sacks.
What you got?
Loot, the snorkel said, which I would really, really like to put away now, please.
Sure, okay, Greg said. His headache felt like it was sprouting claws and digging at the back of his left eye. You're right. It was probably nothing.
Chapter 47
The shotgun blast was enormous. A boom, Sarah felt and heard crash and bang against the vestibule's stone walls. A tongue of muzzle flash, bright as lightning, spurted from the weapon's throat, sheeting the stone gray where it wasn't purpled with Tori's blood and bits of her brain and skull. Without pause, the boy simultaneously worked the pump and pivoted as Sarah shrieked and leapt again for the bell tower steps. Hooking the wrought iron latch with her left hand, she dragged the door partly shut just in time. Another flash, a gigantic boom! Something slapped her right calf, and she stumbled as more buckshot punched through the wood, exploding in splinters that nipped her back and blew past her cheeks. She careered up the slippery steps as her calf bawled, the blood streaming in runnels down her pant leg and sock. Shot! I'm shot! She gimped up steps before her legs suddenly gave. Pitching forward, she sprawled against stone. Her heart was yammering, not only in fear, but pain. With all these gunshots, someone would hear, wouldn't they? She didn't know. All this heavy, thick stone and wood. Maybe no one could. He was down there, waiting, deciding. She could feel him. Have to save myself. She still had the SIG. Is there a round ready? She didn't remember or know how to check. Any sound would give her away. The changed had already seen her with the weapon. The longer he assumed she didn't know what to do, not such a stretch, the better off she might be. Then, the glimmer of an idea. Find the safety. Her fingers walked the weapon. This time, she found the lever and thumbed it off. Grimacing, she eased onto her back, reached down, and skimmed an oozy handful of warm blood to smear her cheeks and neck. Scooping another palmful, she slathered her chest. There, that ought to sell it. One look at me and he'll think I'm dying. Shuddering, she scrubbed her hand on her jeans, then pulled herself into as tight a crouch as she could manage, hissing at the pain in her calf. No expert on guns, but she knew geometry. They were in a tight tube, a circular space with narrow, essentially triangular steps that tapered to a point around the stone newel. He was a boy and much bigger, and had the long gun besides, which meant he had no choice but to hug the outer wall. But she was above him and small. Clutching the SIG, she steadied her hands on her knees, aiming for what she thought would be the most logical spot. Help! She injected as much fear and pain into that little whimper of a word as she could. It wasn't such a stretch.
I'm shot! Please don't hurt me! I won't tell anyone you're here, I promise!
Nothing. This isn't going to work. She listened, straining above the thump of her heart, the buzz in her ears. She was trembling so badly her teeth stuttered. Sweat, oily and as thick as the blood seeping into her right boot, spilled over the shelf of her eyebrows to burn her eyes.
Help!
She threw in a long grind of a groan for good measure.
I'm hurt! Please help me!
A second later, from somewhere below, she heard the distinctive rasp of a boot over stone. A clup, then another clup. Coming up. How many steps had she managed? She couldn't remember.
Help!
Her hands were cramped so tightly around the SIG's butt, the ridged grip digging into her palms. Her right index finger curled over the trigger.
I'm hurt!
Another clup and another.
Please help me!
The newel was cold on her neck. She was staring so hard into the silvery gloom, her eyes watered.
I'm bleeding! I'm...
A dark, stiff finger slid into view. She felt her breath catch as the barrel of Tori's shotgun, just the tip, hung there a moment.
She was afraid to call out again because she didn't want him to look her way. The sound of his boot on stone reached her again. Just that single step, the shotgun moved. The shotgun was pointing up, away from her, and at an angle. He had no choice because of the tower's geometry. It would take time to swing down for a shot. Heart rampaging in her chest, she watched the barrel bob as he took another step, and then another. First his hands came into view. Wait, wait. Then the hump of his forehead, the jut of his nose. Wait just another second. And then he was only 3 steps below her. Wait, wait. And she saw shoulders, his chest, how his head was swiveling, his face ballooning to a gray oval. Almost, almost. And then she heard his quick inhale the instant he realized he was looking in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the sharp rap of the shotgun's butt against stone as he tried swinging down but couldn't, because he was a tall boy with a long gun trying to turn in a too tight space. Ah! The sound was more wheeze than scream, but she squeezed the trigger, and this time the gun went off. Chapter 48. Greg's headache still pulsed in his teeth. His vision was fuzzing around the edges, but as he shouldered open the door and stepped from the village hall's entryway and back into the cold, Greg huffed out in relief. The village hall triggered a lot of bad memories, images of refugees, all of them old and decrepit, cringing along the walls, the council eyeing him owlishly from their raised bench in that bat cave of a courtroom the very first day he'd sought sanctuary. Probably that post-traumatic stuff. Pulling on his gloves, he stomped his feet in a freezing kid two-step, shuffling from right to left as he waited. The others were still inside, offloading their loot. Located below ground and through a double set of iron doors, the basement jail was where they stored what remained of their food and feed, as well as stockpiles of fuel, high-grade fertilizer, and ammo. What nagged even more was how much they didn't have. The jail was wide and deep, equipped with 10 four-person cells, 5 to a row. One huge iron cage, probably once a drunk tank from the faint steeped-in odor of old vomit, dominated the wall at the very back. This was where they kept their fuel stores, propane tanks, red plastic cans of gasoline siphoned from stalled cars, fuel oil, premix. Of all their supplies, their fuel situation was the least dire, simply because no one did any welding, went boating, fired up a chainsaw, or headed out for a nice country drive anymore. All that combustible material made him nervous, too. No one had asked him, but he always worried about what might happen if someone got careless or a spark flew. Couldn't you use premix or fuel oil and fertilizer to make ANFO? Of the remaining cells, only 3 held food, and of those, 1 was devoted to dog food, cans of wet, 20-pound sacks of dry kibbles. While not exactly barren, the steel shelves in the remaining cells weren't fully stocked either. What had looked so amazing in the tight, dark cubby of the Landry's pantry hidey-hole made barely a dent. Those 8 jars he'd hauled now huddled in a forlorn little knot, surrounded by a lot of empty space. As the guard had slotted in the jars, Greg had counted the cans of condensed soup on the shelf above, just to see.
30 cans.
The thought sent a shiver down his neck. That would last 40 hungry kids about 3 minutes. The guards also kept a very careful tally of every single can and jar, every sack of kibble. So just how were they supposed to sneak out food, much less bricks of ammo, for their great escape? Hopeless. He massaged his right temple with a forefinger.
We'll never find enough.
Something snapped. The sound was very brief, crisp, firecracker short. Greg stiffened, his ears suddenly tingling, aware of just the faintest echo bouncing off brownstone. That had been a shot. Headache forgotten, he turned in a full circle. But from where? Behind, he heard the door scrape open.
Boy, I'm glad that's...
Then Prue must have gotten a look at Greg's face.
What is it?
Either I'm going crazy, Greg said, or I just heard a shot. Chapter 49.
Sarah wasn't aware she'd screamed or even fired until she felt the burn in her throat and the kick in her hands. The sound was monstrous, although the muzzle flash was more like the burst of a spent bulb. Yet in that brief spastic light, she saw him drop, not straight down as if he had ducked, or better yet, had no head left to duck with, but backward, just falling or dead. She didn't know, couldn't hear anything. Scrambling to her feet, she turned to scurry up, but pivoted much too quickly. Her right boot skidded on a slick of her own blood. Her center of gravity shifted. She could feel her balance going, and then the scream tear itself from her throat. Sarah knew how to run with a weapon about as well as she knew how to fire it, so she was holding onto the SIG in exactly the wrong way with her finger through the trigger guard. When she tripped and fell up the stairs, her hand hit stone and the gun went off again. This time she lost her grip, too. The SIG went skittering down the steps as shards of stone, blowback from where the bullet punched into the newel, nipped her face and neck and cut fresh blood. Oh, God, please make him be dead or hurt or gone. If he was still alive, he'd now have her pistol. How many bullets did that thing hold? Doesn't matter. One will be enough. She scrabbled up the slippery steps. All she could hope now was that the changed was running the opposite way. Maybe no one had heard the shotgun because the church's walls were so thick, but someone had to have heard those pistol shots through the open bell tower. So where was everyone? All at once, she ran out of stairs and stumbled into a short stone-lined passage slotted with rectangular openings on either side to let in light. Dead ahead, no more than 10 feet away, she saw an array of trusses and ropes and handles that reminded her of a weaver's loom. But where are the bells? She stood, panting, heart thudding, calf screaming with pain, ears still roaring. The bells must be above her somewhere. Lurching to the tangle of ropes, she saw how they looped around dowels and were tied off in hard knots. The icy ropes would be stiff, and her chilled fingers were tacky with blood. If the knots were too tight, she'd never loosen them, but all she needed was one, right? She yanked ropes, searched the knots with quaking fingers, then gasped as the tip of her right index finger slipped through a very small loop. Yes! Tugging, she felt the rope give. She worked in another finger, and then a third, and felt the knot suddenly relax as the ropes parted in her hands. All right, come on! Grasping a single rope, she hauled straight down as hard as she could, let her weight drop, grunting as her wounded calf screamed, and heard a hollow bung. Hurry, please hurry! She sent the thought winging after each bung-dung of the bell. Hurry, hurry, help us, help us, help us! Chapter 50. Come on! Storming down the village steps, Greg dashed to his horse and yanked his bushmaster from its scabbard. He was already spinning away as the village hall doors popped open and Aiden spilled out, shouting over the dung-bung of the bell, "What the hell?" Greg sprinted for the church only 100 yards away, with Prue hard on his heels. Now that the bell was ringing, now that he knew something was wrong, he could hear the dogs, too, very faint but unmistakable, a rhythmic floating from the rear of the church. The dogs and kids must be in the school. God, he hoped so, which meant Tori and Sarah were in the bell tower, or it might be only one of them. Instead of bounding up the front steps, he turned, saw Aiden, Lucian, and now Jarvis, and two of the village guards running after, and shouted back, "The kids! Go make sure the kids!" Then pivoting, he blasted past the church's front entrance, dodged right, and headed around back, slipping into slate shadows painted on snow by the coming night. Side door. To his left, he could hear Prue's ragged breaths. Thought Tori locked it. Where the hell are Connor and Benton? Don't know. He was sure Tori locked up after he'd left, too. What was in the church that anyone would want? Food, mostly. Not a lot, but easier to get to than the jail. Suddenly, his boots skated on something slick. He landed with a splish in a mucky, slithery tangle that reeked of salty metal and the fouler, rank odor of guts. Gah! Prue sounded as if he was going to be as sick as Greg felt. Oh, fuck me! God! Greg's voice was thick with sour puke. He spat. In the bad light, Greg couldn't see if he was wallowing in Cutter or Benton. Didn't much matter. From the size of the puddle and spools of chilled intestines, most of the body, or bodies, was elsewhere. He swam forward, leaving a snail's slick of gore, then got a knee under as Prue dragged him upright.
Jesus!
Prue pressed a hand to his forehead like a kid taking his fever.
A changed?
Maybe more than one. The bell was still tolling. Greg could feel the dry air wicking the wet from his face and chest, leaving behind a tacky, toxic sludge of half-congealed blood and ruptured guts.
Whatever. I'm going inside. Are you nuts?
Prue's hand shot for Greg's arm.
What's gone down has gone down. Stay here if you want.
Greg tore himself free. I don't care what you do, but Tori's in there and Sarah, and I'm going.
No!
Prue tried another grab, but missed.
Greg, be smart! Chris or Peter wouldn't fuck smart, he said. And that just shows what you don't know, because they would, and so will I!
Turning, he dashed the last 100 feet. The door was open, not yawning, but wide enough for him to scuttle through with room to spare. He held his breath as he did it, expecting the shot. None came, and he heard the air sigh from his mouth. As soon as he was inside, the bell's clanging diminished. Directly ahead and up a short but very steep flight of stairs, he made out the arched entryway into the sanctuary. Enough of the day's dying light splashed in through the open door for him to see a stack of folding chairs leaning against the wall to his right. This was bad, because it meant that he could be seen if someone was on the altar platform, maybe waiting out of his line of sight.
If anyone's still in here...
When the bells started, the smart thing for the changed would be to get out, fast, just as the wiser play for Greg would have been to wait, like Prue said. He hoped the changed were smarter than he was. He'd been here only a couple of hours before, and remembered the layout, that the stairs to the basement were on his right. He peeked, saw the door was open, and thought, oh boy, that's bad. With no flashlight, it would be crazy to go down. He heard something shuffle off his left shoulder, tensed, swiveled, socked the bushmaster in place, then felt a surge of relief.
I thought this wasn't smart.
Yeah, so we're both stupid. Now, Prue's voice died as he saw the gaping maw of the basement door.
Shit. Block it?
The door opened out, so that should work.
I'll do it, he murmured.
He didn't want to let go of his gun, but he couldn't do this with one hand. He laid the bushmaster flat, then gently pulled one folding chair away from the other 10, the metal letting out a faint, rasping scraw that made him wince. Slowly padding down the steps, he levered the door closed, all his muscles trying to turn to jelly at every creak and squeak, and wedged the chair under the knob. He repeated this maneuver twice more, moving as fast as he could. Total time, maybe a minute.
Good deal. Anything in there'll be trapped like a bug in a jar. You remember the layout?
Prue chinned toward the sanctuary.
Sundays, I try to sleep with my eyes open. 3 steps, and you're on the platform. Choir on the right, altar on the left along the wall and under the cross. Pulpit at 1 o'clock on the far end. Go straight through, and you'll be in the organist's pit.
He thought.
I'll go right down the side aisle. Depending on what happens next, you head for the platform.
Prue nodded, and Greg took the stairs as fast as he dared. He saw the cross suddenly slip into view on his left, and then the high arches of stained glass lining the sanctuary's far wall. Heard a sudden creak under his boot and thought,
shit, in the movies they hug the wall, so stairs won't...
There was a thundering roar, a clap of lightning. Greg let out a startled gasp as the wall above his head suddenly cratered. Swaying, he stumbled back, tripped over his boots, and fell the rest of the way as another shot blasted past. Greg felt the whirr of a slug cleave air by his left temple.
Shit!
Prue's face swam into view. You hit?
No!
His left ear felt as if someone had crammed in a fistful of cotton, but he could hear the tick, tick, tick of buckshot and the lighter patter of grit and pulverized drywall. Well, at least they knew what kind of weapon the changed had. Eyeing the hole in the drywall, Greg saw the teardrop shape and how it curved up.
I think he's under the altar table.
Yeah, and? Prue sounded angry.
How the hell are we supposed to...
Wait, Greg, why are you taking off your boots?
Giving him something else to look at.
Quickly yanking off his other boot, Greg stripped the sock, then crammed both socks into a parka pocket.
Hefting the boot in his left hand, Greg glanced back at Prue.
He's got a shotgun.
So? Prue gave him a strange look, and then Greg saw the second his friend got his meaning. A shotgun had a max effective distance of about 40 yards. Plenty of stopping power, but if he could get far enough away, his rifle, or Prue's Mini 14, would be much more effective. Prue jerked a nod.
Okay, Prue said. Just run fast.
I hear that.
Greg pulled in a breath. Oh, God, please make this work.
Then he stopped thinking and moved. Dashing up the steps, Greg lobbed the boot in an awkward throw and then immediately dodged right. The shotgun roared at the same instant, following the trajectory of his boot. Through the ringing, he heard Prue squeeze off a shot as Greg hit the stone floor in a hard thump. The shotgun thundered to life again. This time, the pew just above his head exploded in a mushroom cloud of wood splinters. Ducking, Greg threw up a hand to protect his head and neck as he scuttled as fast as he could down the side aisle. Behind, he caught the sharp crack, 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 the Ruger's raps growing closer and louder as Prue stormed up the steps. Wheeling to his left, still hunched over, Greg dashed the cramped length of the pew, bare feet slapping stone, the center aisle dead ahead. At that moment, the bell cut out.
The others are in. They're safe. He felt a sting in his throat, gulped it back. Tori's safe.
From the altar to his left, he heard something shrill, a shout, a scream, and then he was lifting onto the balls of his feet, pivoting, thighs tensing, his bushmaster swinging clear of the pew, thinking, aim up. But he never had a chance to take the shot. Chapter 51. In the sudden, thrumming silence, Greg saw Prue looming over the writhing body of a boy. When he'd been shot, a belly wound, from the way the changed was curled in a comma, the boy had tried rolling away, because once Greg squirted past, the changed needed to move fast or end up full of holes. But the kid couldn't move fast or far enough to outrun Prue's bullets, and Greg saw why. A forked splinter of bone jutted from a juicy rip in the boy's thigh. Now that Greg was standing, he saw the trail of blood smeared over the sanctuary's floor and up the altar platform's steps. The altar carpet was purple and sodden.
Dragged himself all the way.
Turning, Greg followed the blood trail's wavering path and realized that the boy must have broken his leg outside the sanctuary, maybe in the vestibule or even the breezeway. But how? That kid would have had to fall pretty far. Through the sanctuary's thick double doors, he could hear a growing gabble, and maybe...
Was that a scream? Couldn't tell.
Way back, he'd read that you lost some of your hearing if you shot at a range and didn't wear gear. Keep this up, he'd be deaf by the time he was 20. His ears still buzzed so badly he couldn't tell or tease apart the muted sounds seeping through the doors. No gunshots, though, so that was good. As desperately as he wanted to burst through those doors and find Tori, he knew he ought to wait. No rush now. The girls were safe.
We did it.
So why didn't he feel good about that? It was the changed boy, the screw of his face, the way he writhed, dying hard, Kincaid would say. Not right to feel good about that. He started back for Prue.
You okay?
He thought he said it too loudly.
Yeah. Can't say the same for our buddy.
Prue towed a shotgun away from the boy's spidering fingers.
Can't decide whether to finish him or let him bleed to death.
He paused.
Dude's pretty messed up. Carpet's ruined, so's the altar cloth.
Greg picked out splashes of blood on the wood, even the walls just below the cross. If you didn't know better, you'd think Jesus's ghost was up there dripping. He stared down at the boy. 17, 18, he guessed. Greasy hair down past his shoulders, and a ton of yellow pus balloons and zit scars to boot. Someone had rearranged his nose, too, and recently. The boy's skin was the color of moldy cheese, and his eyes, already glazing, were sunk deep in sockets rimmed with fading yellowish bruises. This changed was starving to death, just like them. Stooping, he reached for the shotgun and froze. He must also have, what, gasped, cried out? He didn't know, but Prue said sharply,
What? Greg? No.
Maybe his heart had stopped somewhere along the way. He thought that must be it, because he felt the muscles seize in his chest and his center go cold and still and black. For a crazy instant, he thought, "This will be what it's like when I'm dead."
He watched his hand float toward the weapon, saw his fingers, small, so distant, wrap themselves around the shotgun's walnut stock, then creep over the ridges and swirls of those intricate curlicues of carved flowers and vines as a blind boy reads Braille.
"Oh, Jesus," Prue said, then, "Greg, look at me, man. This doesn't mean anything." But he was on his feet, backtracking a stumbling step and then another, and now he'd gotten himself turned around and had begun to run, the changed blood sticky against his bare feet, and then the sanctuary's double doors were suddenly swinging wide as if in a bellow, because now the voices all crashed through in a huge wave that the men rode, spilling into the sanctuary. The faces blurred, all black mouths, black eyes, and now hands were floating to meet him like exotic sea life on an incoming tide. Of them all, he recognized only three people in those first few seconds. Sarah, hair wild, face smeared with blood. Jaeger, somehow pathetic in a red-checked flannel he hadn't managed to button correctly. And Kincaid, who crowded through with his arms out to grab him, hold him back, spare him for one more second. "No, son, don't look. Don't look, son. Don't. No! Tori! Tori!" Greg wailed as Kincaid wrapped him up, and then there were more hands and other men bearing him to the cold stone as Greg thrashed. "No, no, no!" And in all of that, there was one thing more. The moment doddering old Henry stumped up the altar to stare down at the changed boy, who was, miraculously, still alive.
"Jesus Lord!"
Henry piped, his high voice cutting above the gabble.
"It's Ben Steimke!"
Chapter 52. What? At first, Greg wasn't sure the voice, so dead and flat, was his. Still huddled in the circle of Kincaid's arms on cold, blood-smeared stone, Greg felt 8 years old again, a little boy waiting for the adults to make everything all right, and he had never missed his father quite so much. "Steimke? Like on the council?"
"Holy shit! You've got to be kidding me," Prue said, his rifle still trained on the dying boy.
"I thought all the kids from Rule were dead."
"Oh, Lord."
Kincaid groaned in an undertone. His face was ashen.
"You sons of bitches. You did it. You really did it."
"Did what?" Greg asked as Sarah staggered toward them through the crowd. Her right pant leg was sodden, and tears had eaten tracks through the blood caked on her cheeks. "Doc, what are you talking about?" Before Kincaid could respond, Henry said in his clear bugle,
"Yep. That's Ben, all right. Known him since he was a little guy. Oh, yay high."
Henry patted the air down around his knees.
"Recognize him anywhere on account of that bad case of the acne."
Henry looked down the aisle toward the council members, who'd worked their way through the swell of people crowding into the sanctuary. Greg saw that none of the council wore their robes, and while Jaeger was in the lead, only Ernst, broad-chested and very tall, with a still substantial gut in spite of rationing, retained even a vestige of authority. Steimke, a withered little man, blind in one eye, only cringed alongside Ernst. Greg still couldn't decide if Steimke was in shock or trying to hide.
"Mr. Steimke," Henry called, "this is your grandson, isn't it?"
Jaeger spoke for the quailing Steimke.
"Yes, that's Ben."
Jaeger's tone was even enough, but his skin was bleached so white his bald head looked like a cue ball. Without his robes, Jaeger looked like a homeless person in mismatched socks, sagging trousers, and that red-checked flannel. Jaeger's eyes, usually so bird-bright with calculation, only looked furtive and a little frightened, like those of a mouse that can't decide if running will only make the cat spring faster.
"Obviously Ben got away, a fact of which we were unaware."
"Obviously got away, unaware?"
Rifle held high, Jarvis shouldered his way past the others to stand in the center aisle. Any resemblance to a turkey was gone. Jarvis looked more like a buzzard.
You run this place for decades, make all the decisions. You tell us, grown men, to follow orders from kids,
Jarvis jerked his head down at Greg.
But we do it because we are loyal and God-fearing. And now you say you didn't know this boy had gotten away?
Peter. The realization broke over Greg in a kind of icy wash.
He said they rounded up all the changed and shot them, that no one got away.
Greg's eyes drifted to the dying boy.
So Peter would have known Ben wasn't dead.
Where I was from, before Rule, those kids always came back,
someone in the crowd said. Murmurs of assent rippled through the rest of the men, and now Greg saw more than a few women had filtered in, too, armed with baseball bats, shotguns, like a village mob from an old black-and-white monster movie. He spotted one woman, Travers, her hair a gray fury, clutching a warren hoe, its blade tapering to a wicked point.
Lot of 'em hunted in packs. It was one of the reasons you said we'd be safer here, 'cause all your kids were dead. So how that little monster's alive in the first place is what I want to know.
It was Travers, the stormy woman with the hoe, which she now shook at Steimke.
What you do? Only kill kids like my Lee? Because we're not important enough? Did you spare this monster because he's yours?
Hell with that, someone else rumbled. How many others like that one are there?
Because if one kid got away, or they let him get away, another person shouted, there got to be others.
Travers brandished her hoe like a spear.
So where are they? Where the hell do you think?
Jarvis aimed a look of black thunder at Steimke.
They've been out there all this time, maybe even close by. But why? You said you were doing God's work, taking our grandkids, ending their torment. What did you do, you and that son of a bitch Peter? And Chris, my grandson, knew nothing about this,
Jaeger said, and Greg thought from his tone that this was the truth. Yet Ernst remained silent, not a flicker of emotion on his bullish features.
But Peter knew.
Greg saw Sarah study Ernst's face, then drop her eyes as the first fingers of scarlet crept up her neck. A tear splashed onto a cheek, which she knuckled away. Greg gave her free hand a small squeeze, but she didn't look up or acknowledge him in any way.
Sarah knows it now, too. Peter was in on it all along. Letting some of the changed get away might even have been his idea.
Peter was the one who told each patrol where to go and when.
Because he knew where the changed were most likely to be at any given time? And Jarvis had said maybe even close by. Changed? In the zone? Of course.
Now that someone had finally said it, this made perfect sense.
So did Chris find out?
Travers, the woman with the hoe, shouted.
Is that why you got rid of him? Said he organized an ambush when he didn't?
Chris ran.
Jaeger said the words like a curse.
He betrayed us.
Like you betrayed us?
Until the words hung in the air, Greg hadn't known they were on his tongue. He tottered to his feet.
You didn't give Chris a choice. He denied it, but you'd already decided. No matter what he said, you'd have sent him to the prison house.
Because he defied me.
Jaeger seemed to be getting some of his old fire back. His coal black eyes shifted to Jarvis.
You owe Rule your life. Don't dare to judge. Shut up. Let's judge you for a change.
Jarvis jabbed a finger into Jaeger's chest hard enough to rock the old man back a stumbling step.
You lied. I don't know how many of our grandkids you let go, but that abomination on the altar is a councilman's grandson. You had to know. Does that mean our grandchildren are still alive? Why would you do that? So what are we going to do about it now?
Travers's wrinkled face was the color of a prune. She jabbed the point of her hoe at Ben.
What are we going to do with that?
Uh-oh. Greg rifled a warning look to Prue. The other boy gave a small nod and took a step back from Ben Steimke, who had gone still and watchful.
his lips frothy with blood bubbles.
"Leave him be,"
Steimke wheezed. His face was contorted, his blind left eye as milky as a white marble. His remaining eye, with its faded gray iris, was runny, the lower lid sagging like melted candle wax to reveal pale pink flesh.
"Let the poor boy die in peace."
"Peace?" The way Travers's hands were wrapped around the hose wooden handle reminded Greg of the fighting sticks Naruto used in Ultimate Ninja Storm.
"Boy! It's an abomination!" she shrieked and darted at Steimke. With a sudden violent thrust, she whipped around the blood handle of the hole like a bat. There was a muted thunk.
Steimke's head snapped back so quickly it was a wonder his neck didn't break. A fan of blood unfurled as Steimke let out a gargled and dropped to the stone floor.
"No!"
Jaeger squawked at the same moment that Kincaid bawled,
"My God, what are you doing?"
"Doc, no!" Greg grabbed Kincaid's arm as the doctor started forward.
"Don't! Listen to the kid! Stay out of this, Kincaid!"
Jarvis warned.
"Peace! I'll show you fucking peace!"
Travers aimed a kick at Steimke, who was on his belly, moaning, trying to eel away. This time the crunch and crack as Steimke's nose shattered and his neck kinked too far to the right weren't muted. Blood burst over Steimke's mouth and chin, but his neck did not roll back. It stayed exactly where it was, the ear neatly cupped over the hump of Steimke's left shoulder. Steimke's body went as limp and flaccid as a drowned worm. For a moment, there was that kind of stunned, surprised, soundless hiccup Greg knew well from years of school lunches and dropped cafeteria trays, when everyone was craning a look, getting ready to burst into laughter and shouts of, "Dude!" She killed him. Greg couldn't tear his gaze from the buggy white marble of Steimke's dead eye. He felt his legs try to turn to water. She broke his neck. She pulling away from Greg's suddenly boneless fingers, Kincaid squatted alongside Steimke. He put a finger under Steimke's ear, then raised his stricken face to the woman.
"Do you realize what you've done? What you're doing? You think this will make things right? Killing each other isn't the way to solve this."
"Yeah? Well, it's a goddamn good start!"
Travers hawked out a rope of spit, half-splashed Kincaid's hand, the rest splattered Steimke's glassy cheek to slither in a snot trail onto the old man's lips. That seemed to trigger something, as if the crowd was a coiled spring under more pressure than it could bear. In the next instant, what seemed like a solid shock wave of screaming people surged forward, some stampeding for the altar, others moving to surround Jaeger and the rest of the council. Greg felt hands plant themselves on his chest as Jarvis gave a mighty shove.
"Out of my way, boy, out of my way!"
Jarvis bellowed as Greg staggered back.
"I'm done, you hear me? From now on, you're taking orders from me, boy, from me!"
Greg couldn't have answered if he wanted to. Dazed, he saw Travers and that fury of gray hair lead the charge to the altar as Prue darted left and out of the way. Mouth dropping wide in alarm, Henry crossed his hands in a warding-off gesture.
"Wait, wait, I didn't do nothing! I'm on your side!" he piped.
The charging mob simply plowed the little man under. On the carpet in front of the blasted altar, Ben Steimke managed to raise an arm so awash with blood that it seemed to be drizzling red paint. With a screech that was also a growl, a rising note feral and terrible in its rage, Travers heaved the hoe in a huge sweeping arc, the blade wickered. Ben wailed a single piercing shriek as the blade cut three of his fingers away, cleaving them from his hand like sausages. The hose point buried itself in his chest with a loud and hollow sound like an axe biting wood. Somehow, Ben managed to grab the handle before Travers could yank it free and hung on, grimly, acne-pitted face contorted in fresh pain and new fear, blood sheeted from his ruined hand.
"Son of a—"
Unable to retrieve her hoe, Travers let out another of her monstrous, ululating howls.
Darting forward, Jarvis raised his rifle and pistoned his arms. The butt slammed into Ben's abdomen, and then Jarvis put his weight into it, grinding down. A fountain of blood gurgled from the boy's mouth in a soundless scream. His hands went slack while Travers planted her boot and pulled the hoe free with a brisk snap of bone. The crowd closed ranks. Gargling, choking to death on his own blood, Ben Steimke was lost under a heaving, thrashing sea of backs and legs, rifles and fists, those bats, a rake, that hoe. In the cavernous stone church, the clamor built and fed on itself, mushrooming into an explosion of inarticulate shouts and grunts and snarls. It was like watching ants boil out of a mound to swarm a tiny, wounded animal. Somehow it did not surprise Greg at all to see Aiden and Lucian and Sam in the thick of it. Fresh ruby tears mingled with those of blue ink spilling down Aiden's cheeks. Not to be outdone, Lucian dragged that long and obscenely pink tongue over Aiden's face, licking away the blood. Laughing, the two high-fived. At that moment, Greg understood that this was like the morning his world broke apart, when his parents sat him down to say they were divorcing, and he'd spat something awful before bolting away from his father, who called after him, "Son, son, wait, please! You know I'll always love you!" And what he'd said in return, something so hateful it hurt to even think it, "Fuck you! Fuck love!" After, still fuming, he'd glanced through his bedroom window, just in time to see his dad suddenly slump and their ancient riding mower mutter on, narrowly missing his mother. Not that this mattered, because she was already stone dead. The old mower kept on, eating its way over the lawn and plowing under a bed of late mums before cratering their shed. This was like that. A disaster in progress, unstoppable, perhaps inevitable. There was a wild, triumphant roar. On the altar platform, a tidal surge of hands and arms hoisted Ben Steimke into the air. The boy's blood rained onto the stone steps. Ben's right socket was a blast crater of crimson eye jelly. Greg and the others cringed back as the mob rampaged down the center aisle, pausing only to scoop up Steimke's body, too. When the crowd was gone, the sudden silence was a sound all its own. On the altar, a huge crimson lake was overflowing down the stone steps, spreading in a blood tongue down the center aisle. Bits and pieces of Ben were scattered here and there, too. Greg spotted a thumb and a chunk of something raw and liverish.
"What are they going to do?"
Sarah asked in a small voice.
"We're not sticking around to find out," Kincaid said. "Let's get you three to the hospice. Safer there. Got to work on that leg anyway, Sarah. Come on, I'll carry you."
"No,"
Sarah said, grimacing as she hobbled a step.
"I'll be fine."
"Oh, just shut up."
Prue scooped her into his arms so easily, Sarah nearly went flying over his shoulder. The big boy nodded toward the side aisle.
"Greg, your boots. One of them's pretty messed up from, you know..."
"Blood washes off," Greg said. The left boot was soupy and flecked with spongy pink flesh. Lung, maybe, or brain. No use ruining his socks. Wriggling his left foot home, he felt his face screw into a pucker as his toes squelched. "Horses are tethered by the village hall. Unless we want to go on foot, we'll have to cross the square."
"No help for it," Kincaid said. "Just so long as we get..."
"Doc?" When the old doctor didn't answer, Greg looked up from ramming his right foot home and felt his heart flip.
"Weapons on the floor,"
Aiden said from behind a shotgun and smears of gore. Lucian pointed a pair of mismatched pistols, gunslinger style.
"Now."
Chapter 53. The sky had bled of color. The moon wouldn't rise for hours yet, and the stars were mica bright. The snow sparkled, reflecting the combined light of flashlights as well as Coleman's, and Greg now saw dancing dirty yellow flames from torches of oil-soaked rags. The air was thick and bitter with the smell of soot and engine oil. Greg thought most of the village's remaining adults must be here in the square.
Along the way, some had indulged in a little mayhem, a bit of destruction. To his left, jagged teeth showed around gaping holes in several storefront windows. More shattered glass winked from the snowy sidewalk. The crowd yammered and milled in a restless, expectant clot at the base of a naked oak. Off to his right, Jaeger and the remaining council members stood motionless in a circle of armed men.
"What are they doing?" Greg asked, his voice as thin as piano wire.
Aiden and Lucian had marched them out through the vestibule and past Tori's body. While someone had the decency to cover her with a coat, Greg might have fallen to his knees if Kincaid hadn't clamped a strong hand around his arm and practically carried him down the church steps.
"Nothing good," Kincaid muttered.
The village hall's doors banged open, disgorging four men who staggered under bulging sacks. They were followed by Jarvis and another man who scuttled out with coils of rope. Some people fell on the sacks of food and began wildly tugging out cans and jars. Other hands grabbed the coils from Jarvis's and his partner's shoulders. One man on horseback took charge of hurling rope over a stout, low-hanging oak limb that was still a good 50 feet from the snow. Eager townsfolk crowded in to grab at the free ends. There were so many that those who'd lost out grabbed hold of the waists of the people before them in a human chain. Straightening, Jarvis made large, sweeping motions with one arm. An astringent odor spiked Greg's nose, and he thought, charcoal briquettes. Stepping back, Jarvis said something Greg couldn't make out, and then there was another of those enormous jungle bellows as the people manning the ropes and forming those chains heaved. Backlit by the combined glow of all those lights, Ben Steimke and his grandfather jerked limply from the snow, dangling from nooses like ghastly, deflated parade floats. Because the old man was so much lighter, he rose much faster, his feet clearing the ground in a matter of seconds. Ben went more slowly, both because he was a heavier boy and because Ben was still alive. Not by much, perhaps. Greg hoped that what he saw was the lizard part of Ben's brain sparking its last, but he didn't think so. As the noose tightened and Ben's air cut out, his one good leg fluttered and kicked, his bloody hands scratched at the rope. They were too far away to see his face, but Greg could imagine it, Ben's mouth agape, his intact eye starting while that blasted socket stared in startled amazement. Jeering, the mob closed on the boy, swatting at his kicking leg and body with rifle butts and clubs. Then one person darted forward with a torch, and in its light, Greg recognized that gray fury. Screeching, Travers thrust the flame into Ben's gore-soaked middle. With a sudden whump, Ben Steimke erupted in a sheet of rippling blue as the lighter fluid Jarvis had used to saturate his body ignited. Sarah screamed, a sound lost in the mob's clamoring cheers and hoots. Ben's body flailed, the one leg bicycling round and round, but much more feebly now, trailing a blue streamer that was rapidly yellowing as the lighter fluid was exhausted and new fuel, Ben's clothing, ignited. His grandfather's body, now also ablaze, flared like a candle. The crowd fell utterly silent. Aiden and Lucian were rapt, their faces dreamy. It was so quiet, so completely still, that Greg heard the spit and crackle as the flames feasted, and Ben's flops became jitters and then twitches and then nothing at all. He would think about this for days, grow queasy at the lingering taste of cooked blood and scorched hair on his tongue, and he would dream about it. These old men and women, and the very few boys, their expressions shifting and changing in this play of shadow and light, reshaped by fire into something Greg no longer recognized as human. What came to him as well was Jess, in her unending sleep, walking her dreams, and what she'd said the one and only time he saw her.
"Leave them, boy, they are blind. Odd. Dude," Lucian breathed, "this so rocks."
Chapter 54
"Lang said he's playing possum,"
Jug Ears said. I only been working here a couple days, and he's only ever been off his rocker. Screaming, talking to thin air, sometimes beating up on himself pretty bad, see around his face there. But I've never seen him like this before. Yeah, he does look pretty out of it. My God, he stinks, too, like an animal, worse than these Chuckies.
Old Coot. Peter didn't recall his name. The next thing Peter heard was the scrape of a boot over concrete, a pop of grit, but no bong, bong, bongs or Simon. No visions of holes in stone or orange water, no Chris either. Was that bad? Who knew?
How long you been like this? Old Coot said.
Jug Ears, you mean the shakes or the not breathing real good?
Old Coot,
both.
Oh, mutters as Jug Ears counted under his breath.
Couple hours? He was like this when I come on shift. Lang gave him a whack with his baton, right there in the side. See where the bruise is coming up? Kid didn't even flinch. Asked me, I don't know. The way he's breathing, he's either real crazy or dying.
Both, neither. Bwah.
Naked, eyes screwed shut, sprawled on the floor of his cell, Peter let go of another gargling, guttural groan and shuddered, his hands fluttering like dying moths. His skin was so caked in filth, huge dried chunks cracked from his flanks.
And it's showtime, folks.
Dragging in another grudging inhale, he began to jitter and flop like a dying fish, spluttering and choking, the foam bubbling to froth over his lips. From the taste, there was some blood, too. The back of his head bounced against concrete, and he felt a spray of pain, but it was muted and very distant.
Oh, shit, shit!
He heard the tinkling chatter of metal, then a clack as Old Coot slotted in a key.
Son of a bitch is having a fit. Come on, before he swallows his tongue.
I don't know.
Jug Ears. Lang said we shouldn't screw Lang. He's not here. The boss is back, too, from that training exercise. Now, you want to explain how this kid choked to death on his own damn tongue while we watched it go down with our thumbs up our butts? Get something to stick between his teeth and come on.
There was a harsh ball of metal hinges, and then boots on concrete. A hand on his forehead now, and another on his jaw. Jug Ears on his left shouting,
"Okay, I got a ruler, I got a ruler. Come on, open his mouth, open his mouth. Hang on,"
Old Coot grunted, trying to hook his fingers in the soft notches at the corners of Peter's mouth and away from his clashing teeth. Peter obliged, letting his lower jaw sag, throwing in a choking for good measure.
Jesus, he's goddamn dying!
Old Coot wrenched Peter's jaws open so far, Peter heard the tendons creak.
Damn it to hell, come on! Get that thing in there! Get it over his tongue! Get it! I got it!
A rigid edge of wood sliced Peter's lower lip, and then there was a tick. Tick as Jug Ears tried butting the ruler between the shelves of Peter's teeth. Jug Ears wormed his fingers over Peter's tongue.
I got it,
Jug Ears sang. I got Peter snapped hard and fast. There was an audible crunch, a burst of blood in his mouth, and then he was grinding his jaws from side to side, his teeth sawing through skin and stringy tendons down to the joints. The bones snapped as Jug Ears screeched and beat at Peter's face with his free fist.
Get him off! Get him off! Get him!
Spitting out the ruin of what had been two fingers, Peter surged from the floor. His left hand was already driving for the man's throat, his right sweeping up the dropped ruler. Jug Ears got out of pain as Peter cocked his right elbow and then pistoned fast, driving the ruler into the old man's mouth. Jug Ears gave a tremendous jerk. A huge gush of blood jetted, hot and wet, splashing Peter's face and hand. Through the wood, Peter could feel the harder plate of bone at the back of the man's throat. The guard's eyes bugged, his hands flew to Peter's wrist and tried clawing the ruler free, his nails and jagged splinters of bone from his missing digits frantically scoring Peter's wrist. Rearing up, Peter flipped Jug Ears onto his back, stabbed the ruler down like a pike and bellowed, "Eat it! Eat it! Eat it!"
There was another bony crunch, this one duller, muted by the boil of blood. Jug ears flailed in a brief but violent spasm as if he'd stuck a wet finger in a live socket, the connections between brain and body suddenly severed as the rulers slammed through to skewer vertebrae and the delicate spinal cord. All this took less than 5 seconds. Without pause, Peter rounded on old Coot, who'd scuttled back only a few feet and was now fetched up against the iron bars of Peter's cage. His knobbed fingers scrabbled for his pistol, but when Peter's shadow swam over his body, the guard screamed, "No!" Horror bleached all the color from the guard's face, and Peter had a moment's clarity where he understood what he must look like to this old man, naked, painted with gore, a Medusa's crown of jungle hair, as inexorable as fate. He was something born from a nightmare or hell.
"Don't look at me with those eyes!" old Coot shrieked. I never hurt you!"
"True," Peter said, "but you never helped me either." 2 minutes later, flipping the globe of old Coot's left eyeball onto his tongue, he was at the door. He'd strapped the guard's knife to his right calf, but taken nothing else. No clothes, no coat, no boots, not even gloves. He didn't need any of that.
"But it's cold, Peter."
It was that still sane, dime-sized portion of his mind.
"You're outnumbered. Don't you think you might want a rifle and some clothes?"
"Clothes are for the rest of you." Swallowing back eye jelly, he worried the lens between his teeth and crunched, about the consistency of a slightly stale tic-tac minus the peppermint. From the milky color, old Coot had been on his way to a major cataract. He felt the press of the changed, staring, but didn't look back, although, yes, he had considered releasing them. "Fly, my pretties, fly, fly!" and taking the doe-eyed Kate right there on the filthy concrete in the bargain. But while he was nuts, he wasn't crazy. As strong as he was now, he doubted even he would survive a fight with so many changed. Instead, cocking his head, he listened with his oh-so-acute hearing for Lang or another guard. All that came was the sough of the wind. The icy air smelled of razors and cut through the sour reek steaming from his flesh.
"I want to be clean."
Sprinting across the threshold, he plunged face first into a pillow of snow. His heart gave a startled jump at the shock of it, a baptism first of ice and then fire as his skin shrieked. After so long in the prison house, it was the most wonderful thing he'd ever felt in his life. Gasping, he rolled once, twice, came to rest on his back. Clots of snow clung to his hair. He could feel lumps of ice on his lashes. He let out a laugh that was another of those breathy, ecstatic moans. Snow cupped his back. He was melting into it, but felt no cold. For him, cold was only a concept, nothing more than a faraway twinkle of a distant star. "I am new." He felt the winged presence, the one that had been growing for days now, pulse and swell. Its low muttering surged. "Yes." He pounded his chest with a fist. "Yes, yes!" He was butt naked and maybe out of his mind, but this was his time. It was his. "No one's ever seen anything like me before. I'm a fucking warrior. I'm..." A very distant, very dull thud. And another. His ears tingled as his brain translated. Boots on snow coming this way. Lang or Finn. Either would do. Rising, he bulleted down the wooden path toward a bend where, if he remembered right, the hemlocks were thick, the perfect cover because no one remembered to look up. His feet slapped snow, a dull pow, 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 pow. His soles should be shredded, cut by ice, but he felt no pain at all, no fingers of cold kneading his flesh. Wind tugged his blonde hair, his heart thumped, strong and steady, fueled by the manic exhilaration of the winged thing and freedom. Ahead, hemlocks pulled together out of the gloom. Then he spied a knotty red pine to the right. This was better still, because its lowest limbs were even higher, a good 6 feet off the ground and big around as his thigh. Backing up, he dug in with his toes and took off in a diving run. He didn't even think about whether he might slip. As a boy, he'd climbed higher, taken greater risks.
The thought did flash through his mind that really he wasn't a featherweight kid clambering up to his treehouse to read or dream or sneak his first smoke, that this was an awful risk, and where was he finding the strength, the stamina? Then he stopped thinking and leapt. His palms slapped wood, his fingers hooked, and then he was heaving, boosting himself from the snow, swinging up like a gymnast. Hitching a leg up and around, he seated himself, got a foot under, and then the other, and stood. To his right, another branch jutted at a 30-degree angle, an easy straddle. The path was directly between the V of his legs. Reaching into his long blonde hair, he fished out a slender spike of bone. The bone, which he'd hidden between his butt cheeks, had come from that left foot. Over the last week, he'd laboriously ground the bone to a needle, perfect for popping an eye or jamming through a throat. Of course, if all else failed, he still had the knife, his hands, his teeth, but he really wanted to try out the bone. His ears prickled with the sound of a man's breaths, the squeal of snow.
Wait for it, wait.
In the well of his mind, the winged thing waited too, taut, breathless. Then Lang was there, passing immediately below, a hunched, plodding old man in olive drab.
Now! Peter dropped. There was a millisecond's free fall, the rush of air past his ears.
At the last instant, Lang must have sensed something, because Peter saw a startled silver oval flicker up, and then the black holes of Lang's eyes.
Eyes, eyes in the dark, eyes in stone.
Peter's feet hammered Lang's forehead, an impact that jarred Peter's heels and shivered into his shins. A wild "Ugh!" leapt from Lang's mouth. Peter hit the snow, rolled, set his feet, then swarmed over Lang, still turtled on his back, who was gagging and choking against blood. Lang saw him coming, tried getting his hands up, but Peter batted them away and dropped on Lang's chest. As Lang began to buck, Peter slammed Lang with a stunning blow. There was a crackle as Lang's nose caved, and more blood, a river of it.
"Ow!"
Lang gargled. The old man was far down in the snow, with no leverage at all. He tried a weak punch that Peter blocked with his forearm.
"How did you—"
"Does it matter?" Planting his knees in the knobs of the man's shoulders, Peter ground down until Lang moaned. Jamming the bone needle between the second and ring fingers of his right hand, Peter cupped his left over Lang's throat and squeezed. Not a crushing grip, but enough that Lang's face suddenly darkened. Peter held the quivering spike of bone just above Lang's left eye, so close that Lang's eyes crossed.
"You're a traitor, and I'm going to kill you. But first, I'm going to blind you. You'll hear it, that little pop."
Leering, Peter dragged his tongue over his lower lip, cleaning it of Lang's blood.
"Then I'll eat it. I'll rip out your tongue so you can't scream. I'll take you apart a piece at a time."
"Pia!"
Lang's voice was nasal, stuffy, and the word came out.
"Pia!"
He was breathing fast, his chest heaving against Peter's thighs.
It wasn't just me. It was Weller, too. It was...
Lang's voice choked off as Peter squeezed.
"I don't care."
Teeth bared, Peter rode Lang's bucking hips. Lang's face went from beet red to purple. His bluing tongue bulged through pink foam.
"All I want is for you to die, Lang. Die and know that I beat you. I beat you. I got you. I..."
Peter felt the hit, registered the impact as a solid body blow that slammed him left and off Lang. Carooming to the snow, he fell heavily on his left wrist. A rocket of pain shot into his elbow. The wrist buckled, and then he was wallowing, thrashing, his face half buried in snow. Spitting, he rolled, already aware that the needle was gone.
"Still have the knife."
Righting, he planted, and then rose on the balls of his feet, calves bunched, ready to spring, and felt his heart clutch with fury. Squared in his fighting stance, Davy, a changed boy Peter hadn't seen in more than 2 weeks, only waited. He wore camo whites. His leather control collar was a black cut across his throat, and there was something terribly wrong with his eyes. At first, Peter thought that Davy had been blinded, the eyeballs scooped out, leaving only scarlet sockets. Then he realized that the whites of Davy's eyes were a deep, dark blood red. Jug ears.
"What happens to them?"
their eyes.
No.
The word formed itself in a snarl from Peter's lips.
No, he's mine. Lang's
uncoiling, Peter sprang. At the same instant, Davy leapt, matching Peter move for move in an eerie, silent pas de deux. They crashed together in midair, then tumbled to the snow in a thrashing tangle. Peter's fists bunched into the boy's camo whites as Davy's hands slipped and slid over Peter's skin. Planting both feet in the boy's chest, Peter bucked him up and over in a somersault. Floundering in the deep snow, Peter got over onto his left side just in time to see Davy somehow tuck, hit, tumble, and set his feet with the nimbleness of an acrobat. In a split second, the boy was steaming over the snow. Turning, Peter swam to his hands and knees, but not fast enough to avoid Davy, who vaulted onto his back. A second later, Peter's right shoulder exploded with pain. Ah! Now this hurt. Rearing, Peter flailed, spinning in a mad circle around and around. Clinging like a wolf latched onto prey, Davy readjusted his jaws and sawed his teeth deeper into muscle. Peter felt the spurt of blood down his back. Reaching around, he clawed wildly for the boy's face, then thought, "I'm heavier." Throwing himself straight back, Peter dropped to the snow. He felt the boy's grip loosen. That maddening grind of teeth and jaws suddenly ceased. Bellowing with both pain and rage, Peter kicked up, twisted, got a fist in Davy's hair, cocked the other for a punch. An orange-red blaze of heat detonated in his head, an immense thunderclap like a pillowing wave of napalm. Peter wailed in agony as another shockwave blasted him back. Still screaming, he toppled. The pain was molten and all-consuming. Through the clamor, he just made out a voice he knew too well.
"All right, boyo, let's everybody cool down."
As suddenly as the pain swept through, it evaporated, as if someone had flicked a hidden switch. Wallowing in snow, Peter turned to look to where Finn stood, massive and compact, a monolith in a uniform as black as a crow's wing. A long, curved parang hung in a scabbard from his left hip. At his right rested his pearl-handled Colt. Flanking him were two changed girls, also in camo whites, and their eyes were like Davy's, blood-red pools.
"Ease down, boyo," Finn said.
"No, no,"
Peter rolled to all fours like a seething animal.
"Let me finish!"
"And you will, but not today or with Davy, unless you want a repeat."
It was a question that required no response. Peter spat a bullet of blood.
"How did you do that?"
"Oh, it's complicated. Come on your feet. We're all friends here."
"I'm not your friend."
Blood from his torn shoulder spilled to the small of his back and leaked along his right arm to drip from the knob of his elbow and melt into the snow. The red on white was eerily like the girl's eyes set against the white ovals of their faces and Davy's and probably his own.
"I'm not his. I'm not theirs."
"But you are mine."
Finn's fissured face didn't crack a grin.
"I'm your world, Peter. Look at yourself. Naked as a jay, but not cold, are you? Don't need to sleep?"
"No, but I dream."
To his left, he saw Lang, coughing, struggle to a sit. Already on his feet, Davy slid to Finn's right. Peter's blood was smeared over Davy's mouth in a drippy clown's grin.
"With my eyes wide open," Peter said. "Daymares."
"Ah, yes. The flashbacks. Those'll wear off. They're a glitch." "You drugged me from the beginning, didn't you? When I was in the infirmary and after I broke down and ate..."
He clamped off the rest.
"Will it wear off?" "Possibly, but I sincerely hope not. The withdrawal's a bitch. But you were too good a specimen to pass up. Your brain is already different. We know because you're still alive."
Finn regarded him with the kind of curiosity reserved for a new and fascinating lab specimen.
"Do you really want this to wear off, Peter? To end?"
He
began and stopped. Weren't those two different questions? Being with Finn, yeah, he wanted out. Yet riding that electric red swoon was like nothing he'd ever felt. And really, had that been so bad?
No. I want that feeling back. I'm new, different, better than I was. But if I can hang on to part of who I was, maybe I can use this somehow.
As for the winged thing muttering its dark language, he could live with that. Which perhaps proved that he really was insane and never coming back, no matter what. Maybe Simon had been right.
You were lost the moment you decided the zone was a good idea.
I don't know, he said, not surprised. Great high, isn't it? Bet you that shoulder isn't too happy, but you'll muscle through. And all that energy, mania. Finn waggled his thick eyebrows, which were as white as his square-cut hair. You're not indestructible, but you are different. Tell me, say you killed Lang. What was supposed to happen next? Where could you run?
Peter realized that he hadn't thought that far ahead. Strange, too, how that electric red swoon was guttering. Already he could feel his body yammering after it, craving the rush.
There is no going back to Rule or even Chris. All I can do is press my face against the window. I'm an exile, an Azazel, the red heifer that bears all sins sent to wander the desert. Considering his eyes, that was apt.
You've come too far to turn back, Finn said, as if Peter had spoken aloud. And do you know why? Because you chose to live, to survive, whatever the cost.
Chose?
There was no choice involved. Finn had broken him.
You fed me a drug, locked me in a cage, made me fight, wouldn't give me water or food.
His tongue stumbled. You chose to fight, to eat. You broke yourself, Peter, because of the compromises you're willing to make and the rules you're willing to break to stay alive. And don't you see? You are the changed.
No! There had to be a way of coming out the other end of this.
What do you want? If I was an experiment, if they are, he jerked his head at the red-eyed horrors, what now?
Depends. What would you like?
Revenge. Because what the hell, he was already lost. I want what's coming to me. He pointed a dripping finger at Lang. You've got me, but I want him.
In your dreams.
Snuffling, Lang spat out a jellied clot. How about a trade? Finn said. I give you something, you give me something.
What?
Startled, Lang looked up, eyes wide above a crimson bib.
Boss?
A trade! Peter caught a harsh laugh. What's left that I could have or give?
A few things, Finn said. Depends on how badly you want Lang, I guess.
What? Hand drifting for his pistol, Lang backed up a step.
This wasn't the deal.
Well? Finn's black eyes flickered toward Davy.
Deals meant to be broken and all.
I don't think so, Lang began as Davy stiffened like a dog catching a new scent. In the blink of an eye, both girls swiveled in an eerie, silent synchrony toward Lang.
How are you doing that?
Peter asked sharply, just as he realized something else. At the moment the changed reacted to Finn, that electric red rush also thrummed through his brain, but it was much more muted now, only a tingle. His thoughts were still clear. It's like I'm picking up only the overflow.
Oh, trial and error.
Finn's mouth stretched in a death-head's grin.
I've been at this a while, for decades, and well before the world did me the immense favor of giving us the Chuckies.
As if suddenly released from whatever held them in check, the girls charged. They went so fast that Lang never cleared his weapon. In a flash, the first girl headbutted the old man to the snow as the other whipped her knife to his throat.
How is he doing this?
Peter watched as one of the girls confiscated Lang's pistol.
Is this telepathy?
Not entirely, Finn said.
At least not the way books and movies would have you believe.
Boss! Lang brayed, eyes round as moons as he craned over the girl's blade.
I've been loyal! We had a deal!
Finn held up a finger as the walkie-talkie always clipped to his hip chirped.
Hold that thought, would you, Lang? Little busy here.
But boss! Finn shushed the other man as if chiding a 2-year-old.
Now, Johnny, no candy before supper.
Don't piss me off, Lang.
The code was Morse with something else Peter didn't understand. He caught a T and W, maybe an R. He watched Finn acknowledge, break, break.
And where were we? Oh, yes, telepathy. Well, it's nothing supernatural, boyo. You've got the ability. We all do. Think of ecstatic experiences, how people speak in tongues or crave to let Jesus, Finn sang it like a tent preacher, into their hearts. People love that expansive, bigger-than-me feeling. It's why people have been mixing potions and using psychedelics for centuries since Og wandered about the stars. My particular favorites are those found in the writings of the Hindus, Vedas devoted to decoctions and hallucinogenic elixirs derived from a very particular, very special family of mushroom that not only allowed for communication with the divine, but conferred immortality and brought the dead back to life. But read any religious text and you'll find that all the greats, Shiva, Vishnu, Moses, Ezekiel, Jesus, get high, see visions, come back from the underworld or the land of the dead, and they all hear that still small voice. Chris. Peter remembered how his friend suddenly appeared, and that clear, calm voice. So what did I hear? Who? A horrible new thought. God, what if that was Finn? But hearing, well, God, that's not communication. Ah, boyo, but it's a beginning. Finn tapped a finger to his temple. All this suggests multiple modalities through which the brain can be rewired to receive and issue commands. We know that not only is the brain hardwired to seek the mystical, we can recreate the experience. Goose that temporal lobe with an electrode in precisely the right spot, spark it just so, and you too can have an out-of-body experience. The potential's there, except we've let it go fallow, using speech instead. Yet now we have the changed, who do not speak, but still act together, and clearly communicate with one another. Finn favored Davy with the look of a proud dad whose kid had just won the 100 in 10 seconds flat. What makes you believe that the changed can't access senses and abilities you've let atrophy? And that we, well, I, can't alter the chemical mix to allow for new possibilities? You're not the only one whose brain is different, boyo.
Or who's been fed a drug. And what did Finn mean by not the only one? Was Finn referring only to the changed, or was Finn talking about himself? My God, is Finn different? Has he been like the changed in this way for years now, and only waiting to find people like him? Or had Finn given himself the same drug he'd used on Peter and Davy and these girls? History was littered with examples of doctors and scientists experimenting on themselves first.
You can't have figured all this out just now, Peter said.
Of course not. I told you, Peter. Finn arranged his fingers in a professorial steeple.
I experiment. I have always experimented. And I infer, I deduce. Think of how much more efficient an army might be if they moved to a single purpose. If commands did not rely on only one sensory modality or communications channel, there are no miracles, boyo. Only things we can't explain and abilities we don't know how to exploit, switches we can't throw, until we can and do. The idea, the image of Finn marshalling an army of changed, stilled his blood.
And he said decades.
Finn was in Vietnam. Maybe he was experimenting back then, too, the way the military did with LSD and sarin and other drugs. So if Finn had been at this a while, he just might succeed. The changed were his happy accident, a stroke of very good luck and serendipity, a eureka moment.
I must be the same thing. I didn't die or change, and I should have. All the spared, Chris, Alex, Sarah, Greg, me, were specimens.
What do you want?
It finally hit him that he was completely naked in the snow, having a conversation with a lunatic. The ache in his shoulder had dulled to a grumble, and the pain in his head was only a memory. He hugged his arms to his chest, more from habit than because he was cold. Could you fake your way to being human again? You've taken everything else. You won't even let me die.
That's not true. You wouldn't let yourself die. Oh, wait.
Finn did a mock Homer Simpson slap.
Dole. You mean not letting you hang yourself? You weren't in your right mind, but if you're really hot to finish the job, you've got a knife. Go ahead, slit your throat, stab yourself in the heart, dig out your eyes for all I care.
Choices that were no choices. Finn excelled at this. What do you want? He repeated, and so Finn told him. What bothered Peter most was he could only muster a small flower of outrage. Yet as he listened, this also answered a very important question. Finn had to ask. He can't read my mind, but only influence it. Peter recalled the explosion in his head and the ecstasy of the red swoon. He can give pain and pleasure, which was much less than Finn managed with Davy and the other changed. So what did that mean?
No, he said when Finn was done. Then you guarantee extermination, Finn said. You know they return to the familiar, and the clock is ticking, boyo. Less than 2 months to go, right?
How does he know that? If Finn couldn't read Peter's mind, then the old man must have heard rumors, or maybe had spies in Rule all along. Instead of answering the question, he said, Why would I agree?
Because it's a question of the lesser evil. It's a way out.
Way out? Now he did laugh.
How? You need me to spell this out? You're a smart college boy. Michigan Tech, right? Oh, but you didn't graduate, that's right. A semester shy, as I recall, because of that little... Finn wiggled his fingers. Accident. But you studied this phenomenon. Did field research on the wolves of Isle Royal?
Yes. God, Finn did know all about him.
Genetic rescue in captive populations. So, think of what I offer, Peter. Protection. Enough diversity to keep the population humming along. Food.
He did Peter the favor of not smiling.
Think of me as providing genetic rescue.
But you're not using all the change the way you have Davy and these girls. What about the ones in the prison house? I recognize a few. What are you going to do, Finn?
I might not have to do much at all. You know history, Peter. Rome wasn't built in a day, but it did fall in 3. Rules like that. With the mine gone, no supplies, and everyone so old, the village will eat itself alive like a cancer inside and out. Remember Chucky's return to the familiar. So just think what's heading their way as we speak.
The idea of even a few changed actually making it back to the village sent a slow shudder up his spine. He knew Finn had kids from Rule. He'd recognized the doe-eyed Kate Landry and burly Lee Travers. And if Finn's gathering changed like Kate and Lee, and the rest are his new army, it would be like the last emperor of Rome watching the Visigoths boil through the city's Salarian gate to storm the Seven Hills.
I give it, Finn tipped his wrist to check a phantom watch. Oh, another day or two? Or the prodigals might already be there, Peter. So what do you imagine will happen?
It was on the tip of his tongue to say that the council couldn't fall and Chris would find a way. But Chris came in a vision. Forget the drug. Something's happened to him, and in Rule. I know it. Finn is too confident. The hurt, the idea that Chris really might be dead, was a barb of grief in his heart. Yet he grabbed hold, pulled it closer, deeper, wanting the pain, wishing for the hurt.
If I know what grief is, there's a chance I might come out the other side.
Why do you hate Rule so much? He asked. Who are you, Finn? I am what I am. Finn spread his hands, and mine is the way, boyo.
No,
but you are the only way left. He closed his eyes not so much against Finn, but the sudden icy tide that passed for his blood. In his brain, he could feel the winged thing's claws hook a little more firmly. He almost wished for the bells again, or Simon. Then he would be only insane and have an excuse. All right. He opened his eyes. But I want to be there. I need your word.
Scout's honor. Now, what do you say we get you inside before you lose a foot?
Finn tipped him a wink.
Or something more vital that a healthy young buck like you would be sorry to see go? Oh, but wait.
Finn did a mock head slap.
We forgot Lang. You still want him?
Yes. Peter felt the winged thing shift.
You know what they say about revenge served cold?
No! Lang reached for Finn like a bawling baby.
Boss, no, I'm your man! Plenty more old farts where you come from, too.
There was a scrape of keen steel on leather as Finn unsheathed his parang.
Who's hungry?
Part 4. Trials by Fire and Ice. Chapter 55.
Think you can leave me?
His father's voice was a roar that carried from the downstairs kitchen like a megaphone blast. There was a very loud bang of metal on wood, the chatter of dishes, and then a muffled shriek from Deidre, his father's girlfriend of the moment.
Think I don't got eyes?
His father raged.
I don't hear this.
Shivering under the dark dome of his blanket, Chris screwed his eyes tight, tight. He clapped his hands over his ears.
This is just a bad dream.
But then, somehow, he was huddled on the stairs. Below, his father loomed. Bright red spatters of blood painted his father's face and wife-beater. The hammer was clotted with a gory jam of blonde hair and brain and blood.
Don't!
Dee quavered, except now Chris saw that it wasn't Deidre at all, but Lena. Lena's face was a pulpy, misshapen horror. The left half of her head was staved. A glistening slug of pink brain slicked her neck.
Please!
Lena raised her hands, but not to Chris's father, to him. Because now Chris wasn't 8. He wasn't in bed, either, or crouched on a staircase, hugging his knees, wishing he were anywhere else. Instead, he stood in a swirl of icy wind and stinging snow, and his was the hand with the hammer now. He hefted it, felt its weight, the handle slick with Lena's blood. Gore dribbled over his face, bathed his neck. He sucked wet, warm copper from his lips, and it was the best thing he'd ever tasted, and he wanted more.
Please, Chris,
Lena said.
Help me.
I can't help you.
His voice was older, rougher. He liked that, too.
No one can.
But
Lena's eyes dripped blood instead of tears.
I don't want to die.
You should have thought of that before you changed. Someone has to die.
Yes, someone must. It was another voice, a person Chris also knew well. Jess was suddenly there, silver hair lashed by wind into a gorgon's curls, the snow spinning itself into a long white gown.
Someone will, Jess said.
But not me,
Lena cried.
Why does it have to be?
You're already lost, girl.
Jess's voice was wind.
But you are not, Chris. Leave this place. This is a fight you will not win here. You don't belong in the land of the dead.
Hell you say,
said his father, who was now grinning down at another body. This one was jittering and twitching in an enormous lake of steaming gore. Chris looked and saw that it was Peter, splayed on his back, his head as broken and misshapen as a Halloween pumpkin run over by a car.
That's my boy you're talking about,
his father said to Jess,
and he belongs to me, with me, my blood. There's a time you must kill, Chris, but also a time to heal.
Jess's eyes were black mirrors in which he saw himself doubled, Chris on the right, Chris on the left, like the twin angels of his nature, his father and Jess, but he couldn't tell which was good. Maybe neither was entirely.
"Leave the thing with a father's face," Jess said. "Go back. It's not yet your time." "The hell it's not," he said. And then Chris was swinging. Both Chris's swung, their hammers wickering. But when they connected, they collapsed into one Chris, one hammer, one desire. There was a dull chock and a ripping sound as Lena's scalp tore. The hammer juddered in his hand, the metal cratering bone before passing to the softer pink cheese of her brain. Lena crumpled. When the hammer pulled free, he looked up to find that Jess had disappeared. "That's my boy!" Scraping a gob of brains from his cheek, his father stuck his fingers in his mouth. "Yum!" And then the scene shifted in a quick jolt, as if a hand jammed itself in his back and gave him a huge push, catapulting Chris from this horror to somewhere entirely different. And Chris had 1 second to think. "A nightmare, it's a nightmare, this isn't real, it's not..." Chris's chest suddenly erupted in a spray of raw agony. An electric blaze streaked through his body, all the connections sizzling to life. Now he registered that the air was warm, inside somewhere, not on the snow, and was aware of the slosh and gurgle of water, the creak of a spring, the rustle of cloth, the insect-like tick, 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 tick of a clock. Bed. Bedroom. Where? He lay on his back, quivering, every nerve singing. There was a strange pressure on his chest. Hand. A man. And the side of a thumb on his forehead tracing something, drawing down and across, sketching some symbol like a pen over blank paper. What followed was a swirl of sounds, whispers, and the guttural murmurs of a dark language, like trees weighed down by murders of crows all muttering in tongues.
Durch das Blut und das Wasser seiner Zeit.
Where was he? He remembered, cold and snow, the trap tearing through the trees. Lena, run, run! And then an oily blight moving through his body, smothering his mind. Water. Something in the water. There was that splashing sound again close by, and now something wet dragging over his chest. An enormous gust of fear blasted through him. God, no! Poison! Killing me! No, no! No! Chris heard himself suck in a sudden ragged shriek. No! His eyes snapped open at the same instant that the hands on his side jumped away like startled birds. Someone cried out as he bolted upright, coming alive to a room full of shadows and too little light and still screaming, No! Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Get away from Christopher! An old man's face swam from the gloom.
Christopher, stop! It's all... Get out! Gotta get out!
Chris reacted on instinct and raw panic. Lashing out, he felt his left hand hook cloth. There was a startled squawk, and then Chris was yanking the old man close, reeling him in.